You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Darsha Narvaez, who is professor of psychology at the University of Notre Dame and focuses on moral development and flourishing from an interdisciplinary perspective, integrating anthropology, neuroscience, clinical development, and educational sciences. Dr. Narvaez's current research explores how early life experience influences societal culture and moral character. One of her recent books, Neurobiology and the Development of Human Morality, Evolution, Culture, and Wisdom, won the 2015 William James Book Award from the American Psychological Association. She writes a popular blog for Psychology Today. Darsha Narvaez, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much, David.
So this book, which is terrific, and I recommend it to everyone, Neurobiology and the Development of Human Morality. Tell us about this book. A big part of it, I think, is about factors other than genes that shape people. Is that
That's
right?
That's right. It's a book that it wasn't the one I intended to write, but it was an exploration of what's gone wrong with myself, actually starting there, and then also with society and discovering that we didn't always act this way as the human species, and that what's the reason that we've shifted. So the book explores my journey in figuring out why I would get so stressed out and frozen in when I panicked in front of people, and looking at the neurobiology of that and how that doesn't match up with what moral kind of beliefs about what morality is in Western scholarship. It didn't matter how you felt or what your emotions are usually, you know, it's about how you think and reason and all that. So the book is countering that perspective and saying really emotions make us, and they need to be well-shaped and well-guided in early life, especially in the first few years when our neurobiology is really very immature for us. We're born with 25% of our brain volume at normal full-term birth, and lots of systems come online and get shaped by experience after birth because we evolved this nice nest to support our characteristics, our human nature. This nest matches up with the maturational schedule of our offspring, like as all animal nests do. And we can see now, neuroscience gives us insight into why each of the practices are important. And I can go into the nest, but I'll tell you more specifics about that. But overall, then, we've shifted away from the nest, we've degraded it, and so then you end up with adults that are kind of stuck. They're not fully developed in different ways, depending on when the trauma or undercare or abuse even occurred. And then they can't really function as insightful, wise adults because they've never developed. They've got too many gaps in their neurobiology, in their psychology. And then they create the world that we've come to now where we're destroying our habitat, which is very, very weird for a species to do.
It is indeed. The divide that people think of between nature and nurture doesn't seem quite so sharp and clear in your analysis of the numerous factors that shape a young and growing human.
That's correct. We are scheduled to be shaped moment by moment. We've got thousands of synapses, of brain-cell connections that develop each second. And so the kind of biochemical marination that you're placed in is shaping how those synapses grow or don't grow. So if you're left to cry and isolated as a baby, which is very strange for a social mammal, your brain just doesn't grow very well, or it even melts the synapses that were growing or supposed to grow. So you really end up with a very stress-reactive child that and you don't really know always that you are stress-reactive because your brain comes to a situation with what Steve Porges calls neuroception. You very automatically and quickly assess whether you feel safe or unsafe in that situation, and then your whole orientation, your perceptions, your emotions, your thoughts, your filtering of everything is shaped by whether you feel safe or not safe. And we create all these people that feel initially very automatically unsafe. And then that makes you, that kind of feeling is a perhaps a mild stress response or a large one, draws blood flow away from your higher order thinking. You can't think as well. And your heart isn't going to be open. You're not going to be open-hearted and compassionate in those situations as a way of being. So the book focuses on how the way we are in the moment is really critical for our morality. You can't just be in your head reasoning and thinking and sitting like we professors like to do in the ivory tower and, you know, make good decisions, see how moral I am. That's not how the way it works. It's face-to-face with others. It's how you are in the moment. Are you present, fully present with others? Or are you kind of conditioned by your past to be reactive to that person or that categorizing this way and labeling them that way? That's not freedom, and that's not morality at the highest sense.
So when I'm trying to talk somebody out of a ridiculous, scary rationale for yet another war, and I can't do it, it's not necessarily just because they've watched too much television that week, but possibly also related to their early childhood and pre-childhood development.
That's right. Yeah. So our parents and our caregivers shape our personalities in many ways. Despite people who say the contrary. So even our grandparents' experience can be passed on to us epigenetically, meaning it turns on or off our genes or shapes their expression. And we can be anxious because our grandparents went through some terrible experience or our parents, and then we don't know why we're so anxious. Or our mother was stressed during our time in the womb. And we end up being an irritable baby, which is what happens. And then, you know, the parents can't deal with that, or the caregivers. And so you don't get your needs met, and then you turn into a disagreeable person with, you know, less than optimal functioning. So my focus in our lab is on developmental optimization. We've slipped in our baselines for what we think is normal childcare, what we think is normal kind of human nature and children and adults, what's normal health and what's normal for society to provide its citizens. It's all slipped down and we're kind of spiraling down still because we forget who we are. We've lost our imaginations for our potential as human beings, and we've lost our capabilities almost in many ways to provide the nurturing that we all need, and especially babies.
We're speaking with Darsha Narvaez, whose book is called Neurobiology and the Development of Human Morality. So if you look at the typical child rearing today, modern Western child, and the typical child rearing as far as we can understand it and as far as there is something typical of small bands of hunter-gatherers, what are the differences?
Yeah, these practices that we call now in my lab the evolved nest, these practices are really, by and large, at least 30 million years old. They're part of our social mammal heritage. Humans have slightly modified them overall, but really they're pretty standard, and they're found all over the world. And so they include soothing perineal experiences, so that means not a too stressful gestational period, calm birth experience. No, that means no separating the baby from the mother, no painful procedures. We violate that routinely in medicalized birth. So already you're imprinting the brain there with stress, reactivity, and shaping them to be distrustful, which is part of what's our problem today in the adult world. And so soothing perinatal experience, breastfeeding. This is always a shocker. Our species, on average, is weans their babies at age 4, and the range is something like 2 to 8 years of breastfeeding. We think, oh, my God, what's going on with that? Well, it turns out that breast milk has thousands of ingredients. We hardly understand it. But it has all the building blocks of the immune system, which takes several years to develop. And so breast milk provides that. And it, in any of the studies that are done, it's usually comparing 3 months of breastfeeding to 3 months of formula. So right. There's not much going on there. So we don't really know what neuroscientifically happens with 4 years of breastfeeding, for example. But that's related to IQ, intelligence, all sorts of health outcomes and so on. Should I keep going?
Sure, please.
Okay, so that soothing birth experience is breastfeeding, responsiveness, that means meeting the needs of the child as a baby, keeping the baby calm, keeping them in optimal arousal state so that they're marinated in the good, positive kinds of biochemistry that's going to help them grow optimally. If you separate a baby or you let them cry, you're making the biochemistry shift to a self-protective or survival systems, and that's not the kind of marination that's going to optimize your growth. You're going to might stay alive and all, but you're not going to be your best self or grow the stuff that's supposed to grow at that time. And everything has sensitive periods for growing. Then there's multiple adult caregivers. So babies need 24/7 touch, which is another piece of it, affectionate touch. They expect to be carried and held all the time because they're born 18 months early. We look like fetuses. We act like fetuses till about 18 months. Our brain, our skull bones don't fuse until about that time. So our bodies are expecting to grow that brain, and what grows it is breastfeeding and positive touch. And so multiple adult caregivers are going to help with this. It's just not a mom thing. It's not a mom and dad thing. We are what Sarah Hurdy calls cooperative breeders, cooperative caregivers. It takes a village. That's our heritage because of the great neediness of babies. And after a while, they are developing responsive relationships, mutually responsive relationships with all sorts of different people in the band that they're in. So it's not hanging out only with mom all day long, isolated. That's very strange and weird, that kind of conducive to mental illness. Another one is self-directed free play. And that is where the child is able to do their own thing, run around playing pretty much throughout childhood with multiple age playmates and in the natural world. So they get to know their place, their landscape, their relationships with the trees and the animals and the waters in the vicinity. And then lastly is a combination of social support for mother. Moms are more responsive to their children when they feel supported by the community. And the positive kind of social support for the child, a positive climate for growing, that they feel like they belong, they feel like they're wanted, they feel like they can have a positive impact on others, make them smile or laugh, and they just feel they're very strongly embedded. So those are the aspects of the nest we study. I actually think the nest lasts throughout life, but we're studying it in the first 6 years.
And what is the outcome of such child rearing? You cite the work of some anthropologists who visited people in Malaysia and Micronesia and elsewhere, whose attitudes and beliefs and behaviors are almost unbelievably peaceful and nonviolent to some modern Western eyes. Is that what you get as a result?
Well, you get let me just tell you about our studies of kids, young children. We find that they are the kids who have more of the nest provided to them are more self-controlled. They have more empathy for others. They have greater conscience development. They are happier. They're less anxious or depressed. They misbehave less, meaning that they behave in the right way for the situation. And even we've asked adults about their childhood nests, and we find that that's related to a better attachment, secure attachment, better mental health, less anxiety and depression, better perspective taking, something we have a hard time seeing a lot in our country right now. We are able to actually take on the perspective of someone else and by that, doing that, understand it better. And then our adults also are related, the nest is related to their more open-hearted morality rather than self-protected morality, which is what we see most of the time today. And so, I forgot. I was going to say something else, but you want to rephrase your question?
Well, I'm sort of wondering how we get to a society that doesn't accept things like war and other viciously cruel programs. And I imagine the combination of better child-rearing practices with peace education might get us there.
Right. So the neurobiological part is important, especially in the early years. And that's when these systems are setting themselves up, the stress response system, the immune system, your kind of social worldview. You develop that before your language develops very strongly. So that first year of life, do you trust the world? Do you trust yourself? Are your signals responded to? Are your caregivers trustworthy? And that's Eric Erickson pointed out, that's the really critical thing in the first year of life. It's also the time for attachment to develop. When you feel secure in relationships, do you feel very just trusting or worried about relationships? Those things are implicit. And the Nazis, had a child-rearing manuals or advocated breaking the child's spirit in those first couple of years before because they can't remember what happened, but you'll have control of them the rest of their lives because you've broken their spirit, you've made them so afraid that they will automatically then obey whatever you tell them to do. So what we're doing now when we undermine baby care, which we do routinely in the States with trauma at birth, with leaving babies alone in cribs and alone to cry, with sleep training, which is crazy for young babies, we leave them, and then we don't give them much breast milk, and we don't carry them around with us all the time and so on. And so you're setting up a child, a person, who's going to be stress reactive, and that means they're either going to, if you leave a baby to cry and you then finally do show up, they will learn to scream, but they will learn to react quickly with anger. If you leave them longer than that, and their body will start to realize, oh, I can't keep screaming because I will die. So then they shut down and go into a catatonic state. And that's why people think sleep training works, because the baby finally does shut up. But you've now taught that child to freeze and go into a dissociated state. So when you raise kids to be either you can raise them to be reactive in various ways, and it depends on the timing and all. But in general, you can then end up with people who will be loyal all of a sudden to something that seems safe to them, an ideology will be attractive that makes them feel superior to others because they feel really deep down inferior and scared, but they can't admit it. And all sorts of psycho issues come up, but I'm just mentioning a few here. It's really important then to have the groundwork laid well in the neurobiological part in those first years. And then throughout life, though, through childhood, you want to have autonomy. We talk a lot about freedom in this country, but we don't really give it. And we control people from the get-go. And but you want that autonomy, but you also want to shape imagination. So in Native American communities, historically, traditionally, they have elders who tell the stories about the tribe, the group, the clan, and then they children hear those stories and learn from the stories. They learn from imitating the elders on all sorts of rituals of gratitude and connection to the natural world, and they spend their life immersed in this kind of holistic way of being, and living, that is about getting along and being virtuous. It's really important to develop your own virtues, and very much about, it actually matches up a lot with East Asian views of virtue development, Mencius, Confucius, others. So it's really important not to just focus on the neurobiological part. You've got to have the culture that shapes your imagination. What do you focus? Where is your attention put? Where does your culture put your attention? And right now in our culture, our attention is put on violence, aggression, and consumerism, right? I mean, that's a great way for people who want money, who want to make money off of us, to control us and get money from us. So there's a whole long history of enslavement of human beings that this relates to, but anyway.
And of course, we're told and to various degrees believe that this is all normal, inevitable. There's no choice about it. That, as you note in the book, that we just expect children to be distressed, babies to cry, toddlers to have the terrible twos, adolescents to go through angst and turmoil. And these are not actually inevitable things that are the human character or human nature. They're particular to a society that develops them, right?
That's right. And we are poo-pooed if you say otherwise, right? Oh, you're being romantic. Oh, you're being ridiculous. Oh, you know, all this stuff. But that's because they're ignorant about our history, our prehistory. They're ignorant about all the nations of so many societies that were and are peaceful.
Right.
They just don't know. Yeah.
And people, I tell people, well, let's stop having wars. And they tell me, well, you can't. War is human nature. And I tell them, well, there isn't actually any such thing as human nature. It's just a handy excuse for whatever you want to excuse. But then I imagine you might tell me that peace is human nature. And I'll tell you the exact same thing. I see peaceful humans and warlike humans, and they're both human. Aren't they?
Well, so again, certainly we see humans of all kinds right now, but I'm suggesting that for optimal human functioning, warlikeness, it really isn't part of that as much. I mean, sometimes you have to, you know, stand up for goodness, but I think we are... If we're guided by wise elders, which we no longer really have very many of, they keep the young stallions who want to go to war under control. They give them other things to do. They connect them, help them connect to the universe, which is what the Native American traditions of vision quests do. So you actually feel like, oh, I'm part of this whole thing, and your right hemisphere is well developed, which is the more relationally attuned part of your brain, which we undermine when we don't provide that nest in early life. So you never really develop it well unless you come back to it later, which you can do in therapy and doing all sorts of things like playing with kids face-to-face grows the right hemisphere. But it's really, I think, important to realize that the range of what we think is normal human behavior has shifted. We've got a much wider range of what we think is okay or normal than in our past. So war came about, if you look at the archaeology and the anthropology, it came about from when hierarchy developed, when cities developed. And before that, there really isn't war. There might have been raids or something, or, you know, jealous rages or something like that. But it's really hard to find that war started more than 5,000 years ago or so.
Right.
Well, and we've been around for 2 million years, so.
Yes, it's not typical of human prehistory, but we have as you noted, a weird situation at the moment in which, in my view of morality, the only way a human being can be moral is to be a radical activist for environmental salvation and and against nuclear proliferation and war, or we're done for. I don't know if the morality, if we try to duplicate the morality of hunter-gatherers in small bands, if that will end up being exactly what's needed at the moment.
Yeah, so these are things I'm still working on. I think what we need to do is ensure that our children have the optimal environment for their development in early life, because we need their full potential to help us solve the problems we face. We're running around with half-capable people now, right? And so we have to figure out how to heal ourselves, perhaps through shamanic practices. We have to also make sure imaginations are tuned into the fact that we're all connected and we're all one. You know, that's enlightenment. That we, how we imagine today is affecting how we behave and what we attract to ourselves. And I mean, it's the quantum world of all sort of unconscious, implicit, non-manifest aspects that we kind of ignore in our society because science told us it's irrational and irrationality is bad and all this, but that's not our nature either. So I think we have to remember that we are part of the whole. I'm reading and studying right now Wendigo or Wet'suwet'en, which is this infection that Native Americans have talked about for a long time, generations, that now Paul Levy is saying has infected the whole world, essentially, and it's a kind of a intra-psychic meme or virus of how to think about the world is set up. And so it sets you up, us against them. And it's a very fearful, controlling way of, well, makes you feel separated and alone and, you know, stress reactive. And so I'm studying that because he says that if you adopt the same approach as Wendigo does, which is kind of war against all, then you're in it. You're Wendigo already then. So there has to be a different way to heal ourselves than the way we got into this mess.
We've just got about 1 minute left, so I take it that you believe it's possible for people to correct things in themselves as well as to break a vicious cycle and start better practices with new generations.
Yes, I do believe that. We don't have much time left. You know, the Hopis have said that we're in our fifth world here. We've messed up the previous four. So we have a little bit of time here to kind of save this fifth world, and I think we can do it.
Well, we have to try, and I highly recommend that everyone listening get a copy of the book Neurobiology and the Development of Human Morality, Evolution, Culture, and Wisdom by our guest Darsha Narvaez. Darsha, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You're welcome. A pleasure.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, many in media were critical of Ari Fleischer, former press secretary for George W. Bush, who used the March anniversary of the U.S.'s 2003 invasion of Iraq, based on what Americans were told was the threat of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, as an opportunity to launch a Twitter tirade to say, "It's a myth that Bush lied." He and Bush faithfully and accurately reported intelligence community assessments, Fleischer maintained. Media seemed concerned that Fleischer was insufficiently respectful of the toll of the Iraq War, including what the Washington Post modestly estimated as thousands of dead Iraqis. Researchers would put that number at minimally 500,000. But Fleischer's revision isn't just wrong in emphasis or in sentiment, and we didn't have to wait 16 years to know that. In February 2004, Counterspin spoke with investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus about that pre-war intelligence on Iraq and the role of a secret and largely unaccountable organization inside the Pentagon in manufacturing and publicizing it. We'll hear that interview again today. Also on the show, there is the way elite media gin the U.S. public up for war, oftentimes against countries most Americans couldn't find on a map, like Venezuela. That involves cartoonish demonization of leaders and the feigned outrage at human rights concerns that are not of interest in other places. With the Iraq War, elite media were, after the fact, willing to say mistakes were made around evidence of weapons. But as we discussed with Diana Duarte on the war's anniversary in March of 2013, there is little ongoing curiosity about the other justifications media endorsed, including that toppling Saddam Hussein would advance human rights in Iraq, and especially the rights of women. We'll also hear that conversation again today. Corporate media's role in the run-up to and the ongoing aftermath of the war on Iraq, this week on Counterspin. But first, we'll take a look back at recent press. On March 15, NPR's Morning Edition host David Greene asked his guest Jonathan Greenblatt of the Anti-Defamation League about the horrific mass murder of 50 people at two mosques in New Zealand, how common it was for hate speech to turn into a mass shooting this terrible. Greenblatt's answer began, quote, "I think this act of violence really doesn't have a precedent, as far as we know, murdering people in a mosque like this. And the social media dimension is something new," close quote. The host had no response, but it must have sounded odd for many listeners. Canada is still grappling with the impact of a gunman who killed six people 2 years ago in the Islamic Cultural Center in Quebec City. That killer also, the New York Times reported, quote, "drawn to far-right ideas, fueled by the election of Mr. Trump, and fanned by fears that immigrants threatened Quebec's identity," close quote. Israeli politics is still affected by the 1994 attack on a mosque in Hebron, when a member of the Israeli Army Reserves entered the Cave of the Patriarchs, sacred to Judaism and Islam, and killed 29 Muslims who were praying. The killer's grave has become a shrine for extremists. If we're permitted to remember 1974, some 1,500 members of the Moro people in the Philippines were rounded up by the Philippine Army and killed in a mosque in the village of Malisbong. Anti-Muslim mosque attacks have killed hundreds of people from the Central African Republic to Myanmar to Sri Lanka. That none of this was recalled, either by the host of Morning Edition or his expert source on exposing extremism, is a testament to the failure of our information systems to give due weight to violence against Muslims and the consequent dangerous impoverishment of our collective memory. And Fox News is making hay over a Gallup poll that shows an increase in the unfavorable ratings given Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The network misrepresented the data. The 41% rating her unfavorably are not actually a majority of the public, as Fox headlines proclaimed. But they also pretend, as Reed Richardson notes for Fair.org, that there's no relationship between the drop in the Congresswoman's overall ratings, largely among those who hadn't heard of her a few months ago, and the Fox network's day-in, day-out attacks. Gallup itself notes that, quote, the fact that Republicans are more likely to have an opinion of her than Democrats helps explain her overall net negative rating, close quote. And where are Republicans learning about her? In the 134 days since Election Day, Ocasio-Cortez's name has appeared in 1,173 separate stories on Fox News alone. And no, not the kind of substantive scrutiny that any politician warrants, but things like a news interview with a former Reagan advisor who says Reagan would be angry with her, or Tucker Carlson just calling her a screechy moron. Fox isn't alone, of course. One pundit's summation of the Gallup data was especially telling. Quote, AOC is underwater with every group except women, non-whites, and 18 to 34-year-olds, close quote, tweeted the National Review's Josh Jordan. As Ocasio-Cortez herself noted, this means we're supposed to understand everyone as white men 35 and older, roughly one-fifth of the population, and everyone else as some sort of exception. That is, in fact, much of elite media's definition of everyone, and that's true and meaningful for issues well beyond a single member of Congress. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the National Media Watch Group, FAIR. The toll of the U.S. war on Iraq, following years of devastating sanctions, can hardly be reckoned. At least 500,000 people killed, millions displaced, made ill, their homes and communities destroyed. Of course, the political repercussions in the region and thousands of U.S. service members killed and wounded. All of it based on falsehoods peddled to the U.S. public by warmongering politicians enabled by the press. After months of coverage dominated by pro-war pundits and former generals Iraqis themselves rarely heard from, many Americans likely accepted the official story that the invaders would be welcomed as liberators in the streets of Baghdad. But vast numbers did not. Millions marched in the streets in opposition to the war before it started. But that viewpoint was sidelined and worse in corporate media, whose current rehabilitation of the author of the nightmare, George W. Bush, is only the latest sign of their eager amnesia about the role they played in leading us to an illegal war based on lies. In February of 2004, Counterspin spoke with investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus about pre-war intelligence on Iraq and the role of a secret and largely unaccountable organization inside the Pentagon in manufacturing and publicizing it. Dreyfus co-authored an article for Mother Jones on the matter called The Lie Factory. This is Counterspin's Steve Rendell in early 2004, speaking with journalist Robert Dreyfus.
Robert, when David Kaye announced that he didn't think they'd find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, he was adamant that the administration was misled by the CIA and that intelligence was not shaped or distorted by the Bush administration. Much of the media discussion followed that same line, but your article suggests that there's a lot more to the story. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
Well, I think the most important thing is that while the CIA probably did not get very much right about Iraq, they were at least convinced, most of the intelligence agencies, that there was a lot of doubt, that there were a lot of things they didn't know. The doubts got completely erased in the policymaking circles, and in particular, the Pentagon, which set up its own little sort of rump intelligence unit called the Office of Special Plans under Douglas Feith at the Pentagon bureaucracy, not only was responsible for deleting these doubts, but they had some value added, too. They added in their own spin and their own intelligence, part of which came from Iraqi exiles, part of which came from their own staff, which was doing its own intelligence. And they created talking papers that ended up wildly exaggerating the threat that Iraq allegedly posed to both the United States and to its neighbors. And that information went directly to Vice President Cheney's office and to the White House. And it led the administration in the direction of going to war because that was a war they already wanted. In other words, the idea that they were invading Iraq based on faulty intelligence has it exactly backwards. They had already decided they wanted to invade Iraq. So the intelligence was then used to justify a pre-existing policy. And for Bush to argue, or anyone else to argue, that the administration went to war based on faulty intelligence is just plain silly. They would have gone to war in any case, but they were afraid to make the argument that Saddam Hussein is a bad guy, and therefore for reasons of national strategy, for reasons of oil, for reasons of Middle East policy and protecting Israel, for all these reasons, we're going to invade Iraq. That probably wouldn't have sold either to the American public or to Congress. So instead, they picked on this Iraq is a threat argument.
So, Robert Dreyfus, can I assume that the lie factory referred to in the title of your piece refers to this internal Pentagon Office of Special Plans?
Yeah, it started right after 9/11. Within a month of 9/11, they set this unit up. It wasn't called the Office of Special Plans then. It had a different name. It went from being something like two or three people, and it expanded and brought in contractors and consultants, and eventually took the name Office of Special Plans, which incorporated this intelligence unit. That's what became basically the war planning office at the Pentagon.
And from what you report, they pushed out analysts that weren't going along with the program to some degree.
They really purged anybody who wasn't part of the zealous team of missionaries that believed in the war. These people were forced into retirement. They were transferred to other offices. Some of them just quit in disgust. And they brought in people, ironically, who were not intelligence experts, people who were ideologues, but who were not particularly skilled at either intelligence collection or analysis. So what they did is they took these piles and piles of information with thousands of little data bits, and they picked out the ones that supported the case for going to war, and they discarded all the rest. And any intelligence conclusion is based on evaluating all of the information, a lot of which is going to be contradictory. Some of it's based on forged documents, on lies, on misinformation, on just plain old honest human mistakes. So all of that information, you know, isn't going to agree. And the job of an intelligence analyst or a professional is to look at it all and say, here's my conclusion, and here's the reasons why my conclusion isn't 100%, so I give this a certain percent validity. Well, this office didn't do that at all. They just basically said, you know, we're gung-ho for war, and Iraq is an enormous threat to American national security, and all of the junk that we heard about unmanned aerial vehicles striking the United States and Iraq building its nuclear program and importing WMD-related materials, all of that was a crock.
In your reporting of this, you conducted a lot of interviews, and one that was particularly compelling was one you did with a certain former Air Force colonel. Tell us that about that story briefly.
Her name's Karen Kwiatkowski. She was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and she worked inside the Pentagon in the Near East South Asian Affairs Office, which was where this Office of Special Plans took shape. And so she watched it all week by week taking shape, and she was horrified by it. She is a tremendously courageous whistleblower, in fact, because she's a conservative, not someone who's some sort of fuzzy-minded liberal. She was, however, shocked by what she calls the neoconservative cabal that was shaping the way this office operated. and in particular by the intervention of people like Dick Cheney's staff director, Louis Libby, and others who were tasking or assigning, you know, jobs and missions to this unit, which is highly unusual. It's an office that should work down deep in the bowels of the Pentagon, and here's the vice president's office operating on a day-to-day basis in touch with them.
Robert Dreyfus, at this point, it seems that some very good reporting has come out of mainstream media, particularly from the Washington Post. But some critics suggest that the Post hasn't pushed its reporting to the front page often enough. Even Washington Post ombudsman Michael Gettler wrote recently, quote, make sure you read page A17 or wherever the next piece of the puzzle appears, close quote. What do you think of the priority the media has given to this story so far?
Well, I think it has gotten somewhat lost for two reasons. One is it got lost because the aftermath of the war was so catastrophically bad, with an insurgency and a complete mess and a seemingly completely bumbling administration, U.S. administration over there, that's become the main story. And then second, it is sort of obvious that Bush and Cheney were saying WMD for months and months and months, and we got over there and they weren't there. So what else can you say except, well, we didn't find them and they were wrong? So I think they sort of lost the handle on how to investigate the wrongdoing. I think the core of the problem is the media is unwilling to look at the government and say that there's conscious malfeasance happening. They much prefer to say this was a mistake or this was just, you know, incompetence or conflict of interest or all kinds of other things that are more, easier to swallow than to say that someone was out there deliberately manufacturing evidence. I mean, one of the most obvious cases is no one has really investigated who forged those uranium documents. There's no argument that those documents were deliberately forged by someone. It wasn't a mistake. And finding out, you know, what we know about who forged them, and I believe that somebody in the intelligence system here knows, is something that reporters ought to be just leaping into. And I don't see that too many people are even asking the question. And there are other questions like that I think have just been ignored, and in part, you know, because reporters follow the official investigations, and now there have been several efforts by the Republicans in Congress to intimidate investigations and say, well, there's nothing there. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee has pretty much said that point blank. So I think to the extent that the official investigations are turning into cover-ups, then I think the media is finding it difficult to get these kind of more explosive charges onto the front page.
You've appeared on Counterspin before discussing Iraqi National Congress leader Ahmed Chalabi and his unreliability. A recent Knight Ritter story points out that, in spite of the fact that defectors and witnesses put forth by Chalabi's INC, quote, exaggerated what they knew, fabricated tales, or were coached by others what to say, close quote, the U.S. intends to continue funding the INC's intelligence gathering. The Knight Ritter story hasn't received much attention in other media now. What are your thoughts on this part of the story? Bear in mind that we only have a few seconds left, Robert.
Well, we're not just funding him. We're supporting him to become the next president of Iraq. I mean, here's a guy who's a long-term historic crook and bank embezzler. Now we know he's also a liar about intelligence, and the Pentagon is still supporting him to become the leader of a nation, never mind a couple million dollars to fund his organization. So I continue to be stunned and amazed that Chalabi has any credibility whatsoever with anyone, although apparently he's been quite a valuable source for Judy Miller at the New York Times over the years. So I guess he's got some friends in the media himself.
That was Robert Dreyfus speaking with Counterspin's Steve Rendell. The article, The Lie Factory, by Dreyfus and Jason Vest, can still be found on MotherJones.com. Counterspin spoke with Diana Duarte, communications director at the international human rights group MADRE, in March of 2013. when corporate media were doing their annual looks back at the invasion and occupation of Iraq, largely limited, as ever, to consideration of the war as a strategic miscalculation, but not a grievous violation of international law and of human rights. I started with a reference to a New York Times columnist. Thomas Friedman wrote in April 2003, "As far as I am concerned, we do not need to find any weapons of mass destruction to justify this war." And even though all the talk now is about how we were misled about particular evidence of weapons, the truth is plenty of people said it's really enough that we don't like Saddam Hussein anymore, but that's another story. There was a human rights justification for the war, and that had a lot to do with liberating women. And I don't know how much that idea is being interrogated even today. What do you think we should know about the status of human rights for women in the Iraq of 2013?
Well, it's certainly the case that the justification of liberating women was mobilized very strongly in the early days of the war, and we still see that to this day, that it's one of the straw men that is still standing, and it's so far from the truth. The women that we work with, we partner with an Iraqi women's organization on the ground that has told us time and again that conditions for women now are worse than they were before the war. Now women are facing wave after wave of violence. Women are facing violence in the home and in the street, largely due to the fact that this war unleashed and the U.S. was implicated and very strongly involved in fueling militias that have targeted women, have used gender-based violence as a way to sustain a social vision that is based on subjugating women.
So it really is a systemic violation of women's rights and not simply women as civilians being caught up in the sectarian strife we hear about.
Exactly. It's a strategy. Their vision of the world, the vision of these repressive political forces who have been allies of the U.S., is largely based on subjugating women, on keeping women in their place in the home and of subjugating any kind of secular force in the society. And women have been at the front lines of this kind of violence.
And this has affected, of course, even the drafting of the Constitution in Iraq.
Exactly. Women's rights were quite easily and freely traded away by the U.S. in the hopes that it would create some kind of stability in the country, and stability is certainly the farthest from what we see on the ground nowadays.
Well, there was a report in The Guardian recently that was presented as new about links between the Pentagon and these Iraqi militias responsible for torture and killing of civilians. But Madre had written about this back in 2007, at least, based on experiences of those partner organizations in Iraq. Isn't that true?
Certainly, I want to say that the story that is being told by The Guardian is an important story to tell, highlighting the role of the U.S. and the Pentagon policy of organizing militias and paramilitaries to, you know, purportedly to combat an insurgency, but with dramatic and terrible human rights implications for women and communities in Iraq. But the thing about it is that it should not be framed as some kind of revelation or even as news at this point. As you were saying, we and other human rights organizations have been highlighting this as a policy for years. We did release a report in 2007 called Promising Democracy, Imposing Theocracy, which, you know, named people specifically who were involved in advancing this policy. In that Guardian article that you mentioned, they even go so far as to say that this is the first time that U.S. advisors are being implicated in these human rights abuses, which is, you know, certainly startling and strange for us to hear, given that we and other human rights organizations have been implicating those same U.S. advisors, including James Steele, who's mentioned in the article, for many years now. Another thing that was sort of strange about the article is where they do mention the connection to James Steele in Central America, where he was very much involved in a policy of fueling paramilitaries in El Salvador to manage this counterinsurgency, but again with dramatic human rights implications. And they call it an eerie parallel to what happened in Iraq, as if it's just a strange coincidence, as if he didn't have a resume, a background in this kind of strategy, and as if that wasn't part of the reason that he was brought to Iraq to implement that same strategy once again with similar effect.
Well, the New York Times had a story on how the war's anniversary was barely noted in Washington and had comments from officials and former officials. But if they'd wanted to find people talking about it, right outside the White House was a group of veterans and human rights groups who were talking about the Right to Heal initiative, calling for reparations for Iraq and treatment for veterans. So there are people calling for action today about the impact of this war.
And the Right to Heal applies certainly to U.S. veterans who will be dealing with the implications of this war for years to come, but it also applies to communities in Iraq. One of the people who was standing outside of the White House, as you mentioned, was a woman named Yanar Mohammed. She's our partner in Iraq, and we have been working with her to highlight and to bring support to one community in particular called Hawija that is dealing with the fallout of environmental contamination by a nearby U.S. military base, which has resulted in rampant levels of birth defects and cancers among children who have been born in recent years. So the Right to Heal is something that we'll need to be advocating for and pushing for generations to come.
The last time we spoke to Madres Yifat Suskind, she was talking about that increase in cancers. The International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health said that in Fallujah alone, the rate of life-threatening illness and birth defects is significantly greater than those reported for survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I saw a piece by McClatchy's Hannah Alam about how thousands of Iraqis eligible for resettlement in the U.S. because they risked their lives helping the U.S. in the war as interpreters and so forth aren't getting them, and there's no appeals process. Patrick Coburn wrote about how official corruption in Iraq is so deeply and particularly harmful to development there. It just seems that there are so many stories that reporters could be telling that are not looks back or navel-gazing, but are really today stories.
And also, the stories will continue to emerge, and that it's important to connect the dots between what we're seeing now and policies that, you know, went back all the way to the 1980s, as I was saying, but that we should be demanding accountability for at this point. It's been 10 years, yes, but the U.S. role in Iraq is something we still need to be talking about and that we still need to be demanding justice for, and we'll continue to do that with our partners on the ground.
And that reporters need to maybe change who they're talking to so they can stop talking about how no one's saying anything about it.
Exactly, and that government statements can be convenient covers for human rights violations on the ground, and that the partners that we're working with and the human rights activists throughout the region have been really working hard to highlight these kinds of stories and that they're the ones whose stories should be told.
That was Diana Duarte from the human rights group Madre speaking with Counterspin in 2013, and before that, Robert Dreyfus from 2004. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What to do with all the terrible news about our planet? I have selections from two programs to help. First up are Anna Jane Joyner and Marianne Hitt and their podcast, No Place Like Home. Sponsored by the Sierra Club, their new series gets local action to fight off eco-anxiety. It helped me. Then we go to scientist Rob Muir and his show Environmental Dialogues, as broadcast on the Voice America Variety Channel. Rob interviews UK philosopher Rupert Reed and academic-gone activist Alison Green to get the latest about the viral action group Extinction Rebellion. It's activism for you, this week, with Radio EcoShock.
Anna Jane Joyner, a climate activist living on the Gulf Coast of Alabama.
And I'm Marianne Hitt, climate activist and director of Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, living in the West Virginia Hills. And this is No Place Like Home, a show that gets to the heart of climate change.
Today we're launching our brand new season, All the Climate Feels.
Climate change can make us feel a lot of things, freaked out, paralyzed, anxious, angry, sad, even depressed. And so this season, No Place Like Home is going there.
Join us as we get personal with experts and people on the front lines to find out how they're coping and what we can all do to find strength, peace, courage, and even joy in the face of climate change.
Today, we are exploring a phenomenon called eco-anxiety by experts. It's a fairly recent psychological disorder that's affecting an increasing number of people who are worried about the environmental crisis. So what is eco-anxiety? Is it even real? And how do we deal with it?
We talk with Dr. Renee Lertzman, an expert on eco-anxiety. In this episode, we turn to her to explore how climate change affects us emotionally.
But first, Anna Jane and I have some catching up to do. Anna Jane, how are you?
Oh my gosh, I am doing pretty well, all things considered. I'm so excited to be back podcasting with you. I've missed you and I've missed our listeners.
I know. I'm so excited. No Place Like Home is back and I'm back talking with you. And we have such a exciting season in store for folks.
And how have you been doing?
Well, I have been great on many levels. You know, this is a beautiful world, and we had a nice family vacation to Montana, to Yellowstone and Glacier before the glaciers are all gone, and also some of the sad things. My dog died, which was, as you know, my fellow dog lover, very heartbreaking. And, you know, work is hard. I mean, trying to keep moving from coal to clean energy in the Trump era is very stressful. And then when you add onto that the stress of our political, larger political climate, sometimes it's just hard to put one foot in front of the other. There's a lot to be thankful for, but it also feels hard right now. It feels hard.
Yeah, I totally feel you. It's been a rough couple of weeks. And I'm kind of in a similar boat. Like, it's just the beginnings of fall and it's beautiful. And there's so much to be thankful for. But these past couple of weeks have just been brutal. I have literally done yoga pretty much every single day just to stay sane and, you know, really try to unplug and not just watch the news 24/7. But even in taking those self-care precautions, I had a day where I just had to take off work, you know, and I just had to separate myself from all of it because it is so emotionally overwhelming. And I'm really glad we're having this conversation about anxiety and how to cope with it, because the world feels quite heavy and hard right now on a lot of levels. And I just think it's so important to explore ways to, you know, to stay healthy and sane in the midst of all this madness.
And you, like many people, have been experiencing not just political and metaphysical storms, but actual real life storms. You were in the midst of some hurricanes this summer. I'm so glad that you're okay.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that has been a rough hurricane season and we are still in it. I just get really like physically stressed out, you know, like my body is tight. I have a hard time breathing. And just all the anxiety around all the preparation, you know, my 9-year-old grandfather lives 2 houses down. So the evacuation plan is much more complicated because of that. And just the anxiety of thinking about losing your home and losing, you know, we live on this place that's been in my family for over a century. And that's so emotionally and personally meaningful to us. It's just like logistically difficult to deal with these storms. And it's like emotionally exhausting. Yeah, it was rough. And that was just a baby storm. And then of course, I go up to visit my family in North Carolina, the week after that happened, because it was my dad's 69th birthday. Happy birthday, Daddy. And then Florence, this monster storm starts while I'm in North Carolina, starts barreling towards the North and South Carolina coast. And I'm like, you know, we're doing birthday celebrations. And I'm looking at the news and all my friends who are meteorologists and following this. And they're like, this is really serious. This is bad. And it was really bad. You know, one of my sisters had to evacuate down here from Charleston. It just hit almost straight on to my parents' beach house just north of Wilmington. And we really weren't sure if we were going to have a beach house at the end of that. And we were lucky we still do and had pretty minor damage, all things considering. But, you know, my dad's really upset because that's like his favorite place in the world. And we're all, you know, not just worried about the coast, but worried about flooding in Charlotte and Asheville, where the rest of my family lives. And, you know, I'm checking in with my dad and my brother and sister who stayed in the Carolinas just to make sure that they're safe. And yeah, the whole thing was a harrowing couple of weeks of extreme anxiety.
Oh, well, I am so sorry. Yeah, that just sounds so stressful and so scary and so all consuming. And you're not alone. I am sure that some of our listeners had those experiences this summer, whether it was those huge storms on the Atlantic coast or the fires in the West, which again, I mean, there is, you know, a lot of people describing this as the summer that never was in the West in some places, because they'd like could literally practically breathe all summer long. So, you know, climate change is real and it's landing on our doorsteps today. It's not a problem for our grandchildren. And a lot of people are waking up to this and really struggling with it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I've heard not even just like witnessing my own family and friends' anxiety around both wildfires and hurricanes. A lot of our listeners have reached out to us to share how, you know, how freaked out this is living in a climate change world. And it's, you know, it's scary. So I'm really, really glad that we are grappling with not only anxiety and eco-anxiety, but also what we do with it. You know, we still live, and despite all of these harrowing, scary things happening in the world is still beautiful and full of life and love. And I have to remind myself a lot these days to stay connected to those things as well, because there is so much to be joyful about and to be thankful for. And I think I'm really excited to talk to folks about what we do with these emotions and you know, the kind of severe mental challenges that they're presenting to more and more people, but also what are some positive things that we can do to move through them and to help navigate them. So I'm really excited to jump into this season.
Me too. And also, you know, as someone who is an advocate who does this for a living, how you keep doing the work in the midst of some of those kind of overwhelming feelings, because we got to keep doing the work and we've got to do it from a good place. So we can't wait to share the season with you, and we'll be back right after this.
Hi, my name is Marina and I'm from Longview, Texas. Here's one way I stay sane in the face of climate change. I think a lot about my place on the earth and my connection to the earth. Concepts like Joanna Macy's, the web of life cradles us and calls us to weave it further. This helps me feel like more than a carbon footprint. Then when I'm still and feeling connected, I sit in this awareness and pray for the earth, for solutions. I spend time visualizing a healed world. I try to tend to my grief as it arises and make it a discipline to talk to the people around me about climate change and my reactions. For so long, I struggled with guilt for my personal contributions, even after taking lots of steps to simplify and lower my footprint. Now I focus more on being a voice for the Earth and helping by being a part of the many voices pushing for solutions.
So, Anna Jane, I want to kick this off by sharing some highlights with you from a really fascinating conversation I had with a woman who you know, who has been studying eco-anxiety for decades.
Ah, I'm so excited. You talked to Renee Lertzman, right? Or Dr. Renee Lertzman, I should say. How did the interview go?
It was really incredible. Renee, you know her, but she is such a committed and thoughtful and really profound leader who has been looking at the intersection of psychology, essentially, and climate change, and looking at how that affects our mental health, both in terms of how we respond to climate change, but also how it kind of interferes sometimes with our ability to do anything about it. So, you know, for me as both a mom and a person living in this world, but also as an advocate, it was really an incredible conversation. But basically, you know, the concept is that, you know, we all know that we are hurting the planet, and it gives people these complicated emotions like being sad or feeling overwhelmed or feeling apathy or, you know, grief once you kind of realize what is going on. And so I visited her. She lives out in the Bay Area, and I was out in San Francisco for the Global Climate Action Summit in September. And that was when I visited her and had this conversation.
Yeah, I'm so excited to hear more. I want to know, like, how did she get started? Like, what brought her to this kind of intersection of psychology and climate change and eco-anxiety?
Well, that was fascinating. So she was in college. It was back in the 80s, and she was taking classes in psychology and then also in environmental studies. And it really struck her confusing as to why these two disciplines were so separate from each other.
So I was experiencing incredible anxiety and all kinds of distress over what I was learning in my environmental studies class. And the way it was being presented struck me as a bit strange, and that, you know, every week we would have these lectures about all kinds of just incredible ecological crises, whether it was, you know, about deforestation or species loss, mountaintop, you know, removal. And it would be in these lectures hearing about all the issues, and then everyone would just sort of leave and go about our day, and as if it was not utterly devastating and traumatic things to be learning about, especially as a young person, but at any age. And then I would go over to my psychology class, and again, you know, social psychologist, very well known, talking only about the classic kind of human psychological issues. We were looking at aggression and prejudice and themes that are really big in social psychology, attitudes and beliefs and all of that. And of course, none of it was touching on what was going on with our relationship to the world and to the environment. And so it just became very clear to me that there was something profoundly missing here.
So she went on to make it her life's mission to try to connect those dots and, you know, help people tap into essentially the emotional and psychological components of the environmental movement, which I can tell you as an advocate who's been doing this work for 20 years is very rare. And honestly, when I was sitting there talking to her, it was kind of an aha moment that not only had I not ever thought about that before, but then it sort of struck me as, well, why? Why have I never thought about the sort of the behavioral and psychological elements of this? So she made that her mission to connect those dots.
It's so fascinating and so personally relevant to my life. You know, I come from an amazing family of brilliant, artistic, kind, crazy people, but we also, one of the gifts and curses of my lineage is that a lot of us struggle with pretty severe anxiety, like pretty much like one out of two of us on my mom's side of the family has struggled with some sort of issue around mental health and anxiety or depression. And so I think I would have a high level of anxiety, even if it was like a perfect world full of rainbows and no climate change all the time. But I will say that going into this field was definitely a complicating factor, because it is, you know, just going to work every day trying to save humanity from a suicide mission is pretty emotionally intense work. And I remember kind of in my like early to mid career thinking about how the there really does need to be better kind of emotional support and mental health support for activists who are just immersed in these massive problems, you know, all the time for our everyday living and life. I know for me, I've had bouts with really bad panic attacks and panic disorder, which almost always is connected to my work. That's like when they became most prevalent. It's one of the reasons we left New York, is I was having panic attacks, you know, anywhere from like 3 to 5 times a week. And I just had this like visceral thing inside me that was like, you have to get out of this situation. And I left my amazing but very intense job as the, you know, working in the climate space, and came down to Alabama to live on the ocean and kind of continue to work on climate change because it's my calling and my passion. But I just needed to figure out a more sustainable way of doing it, because I realized that if I kept going at that rate without taking care of my mental health and my even my physical health, then I was going to burn out and I wouldn't be able to continue to help, you know, fight climate change. So I'm really, really fascinated by these intersections, and they have personally big themes in my life. And I'm grateful to hear Renee's story and to be having this open conversation about it, because I don't think we talk about it enough.
Well, I am sorry very much to hear about how hard that has been for you. And I expect a lot of our listeners can relate too. I did ask Renee about that, about where you start to connect those dots between the emotional things that are at play under the surface when it comes to climate change. Here's what she had to say.
I think number one is to recognize environmental issues, and that includes climate issues, as in fact emotionally complicated, that these issues are going to be complicated for each one of us in very different ways, depending on who you are, where you're coming from. So it's not generalizing to say everyone is equally as freaked out as everyone else. But I think the first thing is to, number one, recognize that these are emotionally charged issues, and that if you are experiencing anxiety, fear, anger, that whole range of emotions, to know that that's totally natural and it makes complete sense. So that itself, I think, can be a powerful intervention for people, because it helps just normalize that, okay, if I'm feeling these things, there's nothing wrong with me. And chances are that a lot of other people are feeling this way too, but we're not talking about it.
It's so good. I'm just so grateful. This world is so crazy complicated and weird and harmful in a lot of ways. And, you know, looking at climate change and looking at the Kavanaugh hearings and looking at all of these layers and dynamics that are troubling and disturbing, it makes sense that we are struggling with anxiety and depression. We would almost be crazy not to be.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, even for people who aren't feeling all of this in such an intense way, I think that to sort of go to the opposite extreme as climate activists, we can sometimes shut down the emotional side of this issue altogether, maybe because we just feel like it's sort of too much to bear. But what Renee was saying when I talked with her is that if we don't face our feelings, however intense they may be, whether they're as intense as yours or maybe less so in the case of for other folks, and just take a look at those, that we aren't taking action in as sort of as strong and powerful a way as we could. So let's listen to that.
You know, like real resilience and capacity has to include our ability to bring our full selves. And that includes our feelings. And that includes the conflicts that might come up, the ambivalence, the anxiety, all those things that I talk a lot about. That's resilience. That's health. That's being an integrated human and an integrated professional. You know, I was just at the Global Climate Action Summit, where it was sort of a quick exposure to how even, you know, at a very high level, leaders around the world are thinking and talking about these issues. And what I noticed was a emphasis on solutions and action. You know, it's even in the name Global Climate Action Summit. And my sense was there wasn't nearly enough attention on what are the capacities that we need to be really cultivating in ourselves and with the communities we're working with.
So she mentions the Global Climate Action Summit, and that was a big event with business leaders, world leaders, philanthropists, you know, making big commitments around the United States meeting its Paris climate commitment, which is obviously a critical thing to be doing in the era of Trump. There were also folks who were who were outside protesting the event because of the urgency of the climate crisis. They felt that it wasn't going far enough and that some of the leaders who were in the room could have been doing a lot more. So it was high profile, very intense kind of an experience. Within the venue itself, there certainly was not much talk about the emotional side of this for many speakers, although Jane Goodall talked in a very moving way about her view of this work as spiritual work. And I thought that was one of the moments where it really kind of broke through.
When I'm out in the rainforest, mm-hmm. I have a spiritual connection because you understand the interconnectedness of all things, where every little species has a role to play. And so protecting the rainforest, of course, it's desperately important for climate change with its ability to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, give out oxygen, protect what we call the ecosystem services of the forest, but, you know, clean water and air and protecting soil erosion. But for me, it's more than that. It's protecting something which, for me, is a connection to some great spiritual power. And that's why I have such affinity with the indigenous people around the world. We feel the same about the forest.
Anyone who was in the room was incredibly moved by that. And I think it was a little glimmer of the power of amidst, you know, all of these grand speeches and proclamations of tapping into emotions and tapping into, I think, the real, I guess, you know, real fear that people have that we're not going to get this figured out fast enough, despite all of the great activism that's happening out there and all the great commitment. So obviously, activism is one way that I deal with my eco-anxiety, that I channel it into trying to do good work for the world. But obviously, like, not everybody can get there, again, because I think they can find all of this so overwhelming. And Renee did a really nice job of breaking this down, of when people are confronted with the understanding of what's happening to the world, whether it's species extinction or climate change or all the plastic in the ocean or whatever it might be. When people are confronted with this, we take these scary issues and our role in them. And then she broke them down into these three A's that I found super helpful. So let me share that with you. So the first A, when we're confronted with this big, scary information, is anxiety, of course. So let's listen to that part of our conversation.
So what does this mean? What does this mean for me? This is really intense. I don't know what to, you know, how to deal with this. This is overwhelming. I'm just one person, you know, all that kind of anxiety that can come up. And then there's ambivalence. That's the second A, which is huge. And I would love us to spend more time really understanding and working with ambivalence, which is part of me wants to do this and part of me doesn't. And that's really huge. It's really what I believe keeps a lot of people stuck in an inactive paralysis place, which, again, you know, I think if we understand how to work with people's ambivalence, we can unlock a lot of capacities.
Okay, so you've got anxiety and then ambivalence. What's the third A?
Aspiration.
And so the climate movement, the environmental movement, tends to only focus on aspiration. And personally, we feel that we should be doing that. Like, oh, I want to stay positive. I want to stay connected with my aspiration. But actually, from a, you know, psychological perspective, that's not totally, you know, it's not a grounded place to be coming from. Who is only aspirational all the time? So where I'm coming from with the three A's is first to tune into our own three A's, which is to notice, where am I having anxiety? Where's my ambivalence? Where's my aspiration? And to be very compassionate with ourselves about wherever we are and to just stop beating up ourselves about what we're doing, what we're not doing. That's actually really not helpful. And it's just unfair to ourselves because we are where we are and we're part of a much bigger system. And I think a lot of energy around the self-beratement and I could be doing more is actually, it's pretty damaging. So having compassion for the anxiety, ambivalence, and really tuning into where your aspiration is so that we start to practice a more integrated approach.
I love that. It's really interesting just thinking about how these three A's have played out in my life, both personally and professionally. I think for a long time, I, like most in the climate movement, was just like fully bought into aspiration and, you know, just really threw myself into my work in climate activism as my way of psychologically grappling with this, of giving the world something I thought that was positive. and hopefully was positive, but I did it at the expense of not addressing the other two issues. So I just kind of buried those, the anxiety and the ambivalence. And I really did kind of have to come to a breaking point where almost like I was like, I can't keep still being aspirational. Like I can't keep pouring all of my energy into my work, into activism. Like I have to take a step back and wrestle with the anxiety and these other complicated emotions.
Just to springboard off of that, I think that for me personally, it shows up a little bit less as anxiety per se, but more of the, because I am an incredibly aspirational, ambitious person. And like, I do believe there's a pathway to solve this problem. And I'm throwing everything I can into realizing that. It's the having that not be grounded. There is a lot of, I should be doing more, kind of beating myself up. Like I should, this isn't happening fast enough. And that definitely spoke to me. I was like, oh yeah, raising my hand over here as one of those people who feels that every day. So, you know, I think the bottom line for Renee is that acknowledging and just letting yourself actually experiencing your feelings, whatever they are, however sort of intense they are on the spectrum, but just not sort of boxing them up or compartmentalizing them is key, because that opens you up to coping with them yourself and also connecting better with other people. So let's listen to her talk about that a little bit.
And I still feel that no matter what mode that is for you, whether it's through whatever expressive way, talking with people, writing, you know, singing, painting, whatever that is, the ability to take your experience and then communicate that is very transformative. It's very healing. It helps us remember we're not alone. It can shift the energy from feeling stuck to feeling activated. It can actually open up to ourselves more possibility and reflection on what other ways we might be able to plug in and engage.
Yeah, and that was something really powerful for me, was that this wasn't just about sitting quietly in a room, you know, getting in touch with your emotions, but this actually could make the actions that we take more effective and more powerful because they're grounded in these emotions that are actually something that connects us with other people, instead of just jumping into the to-do list, into the aspiration that are the actions that we take, if they're grounded here in the other two A's, can in the anxiety and the ambivalence actually can have more impact. And another just last takeaway that was really powerful for me were her thoughts about being vulnerable, which again, as a leader in the climate world is something I frankly find a little daunting sometimes. But it goes hand in hand with confronting our eco anxiety, which is just sharing it with others. So let's hear a little more about that.
I mean, I can't say enough about how powerful vulnerability really is, and that if more leaders and more people who are out there on the front lines can show up fully in our vulnerability to be really open and honest to say, look, you know, I'm feeling pretty freaked out right now, but yet I'm standing here and I'm still doing this work. It's relatable. It's really, it's a basis for building trust and building connection.
And Anna Jane, you did that when you were going through the hurricane. And I just really have always admired that about you and definitely admired it this summer.
Thank you. That means a lot. I mean, vulnerability is really, really scary. And being public about your struggles doesn't come easy to me at all. But I've found so much courage and strength in connecting with other people. When I found that being vulnerable has allowed me to connect with so many other people who are on this journey and to share solidarity and support and tips on how to navigate it. And I want to be human and real and vulnerable in how I, you know, fight climate change. I actually think it kind of requires that. It, at least I know it does for me. And I've also, it has brought a lot of healing. I'm in a much, much better place right now than I was, you know, a year ago. And I think part of that was just being real with myself and being real with others. So thank you.
Well, and that's what we're going to do this whole season of No Place Like Home, which I'm so excited about. We really want to go there. You know, we want to go there on the emotional and the psychological and the spiritual landscape of climate change, because both in part because we know this is hard stuff to hear and process. I mean, we both struggle with it every day, but also because as Renee mentioned in the interview, when we don't connect with it, the actions that we take aren't as powerful. We're missing a key thread of our work when we don't tap into these deeper veins. So we want to find more ways to talk about it, and we want to find new angles to explore it. And we're going to bring all that to you this season.
Yeah, we're going to look at how eco-anxiety affects kids. We're going to explore spirituality and eco-anxiety.
Yes, I just had the most incredible conversation with Karenna Gore, Al Gore's daughter and a leader on faith and climate change, about that. And
We have episodes about strength and art and courage and humor in the face of climate change and eco-anxiety. And it's just going to be a really rich, really deep, hopefully kind of surprising and innovative season of conversations.
So stay tuned, y'all. We're so glad to be back with you. And we can't wait to share our next episode coming soon. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and we will be posting all episodes and updates and information on our Twitter page at NPLH Podcast. So be sure to follow us there.
Tweet at us. Again, we're at NPLH Podcast.
And remember, there is no place like home.
That was Anna Jane Joyner and Marianne Hitt and their helpful podcast, No Place Like Home. Get it free on iTunes. I'll put links in my blog.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Now we get the latest on the Extinction Rebellion, courtesy of Rob Muir and his show, Environmental Dialogues.
Welcome to Moyer's Environmental Dialogues, Ocean River Shields of Achilles, with your host, Dr. Rob Muir. Find out what others are doing and what you can do to create a greener and blue planet Earth. Now, here's Dr. Rob Muir.
Welcome. Welcome. Today, we are talking about the Extinction Rebellion. This is a new movement that's gathering and heading up steam to stave off the Anthropocene extinction, and what this involves and what's happening with this group that is getting a big name for itself is going to be the focus of today's episode. And I'm grateful for the presence of Rupert Reed, is going to be with us. And Rupert is a reader of philosophy at the University of East Anglia, chair of the UK-based think tank Greenhouse, and a former Green Party of England and Wales councillor, spokesperson, European parliamentary candidate, and national parliamentary candidate as well. Hello, Rupert.
Hello there.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. Where are you calling us from?
Well, I live in Norwich, in the heart of East Anglia, but I'm actually calling you from Cambridge, where I've just launched my new book on film and philosophy and ecology.
Congratulations. Our other guest is Dr. Alison Green, is a UK cognitive psychologist in the area of human learning and skill acquisition. Alison is the former pro vice chancellor at Arden University. Okay, Alison. Alison and I are working together on a number of projects. So, but I got to ask you for the public, why former?
Hi, everyone. Former because I took a very large decision a couple of months ago to resign from my post and swap academia for full-time activism.
Yeah, it's just remarkable, you know, because I look at your resume and you've been doing all these steps, getting higher and higher and doing more and more in academia, and then you just stepped away. Why?
Yeah, I guess I had a kind of epiphany a couple of years ago, and I got to a point in my career where suddenly I realized that actually the career didn't really matter, and what really mattered to me was putting myself into something that I actually believe in and something that enabled me to maintain my integrity. And so I wanted to leave the system. Basically, I wanted to extricate myself from the current economic system as best I could, and do something that I can believe in.
And so what did you come up with to do?
Well, I became involved with Extinction Rebellion, which began its life formally late last year, although the ideas had been in development with the two, well, with the key founders of the group for quite some time. So that's Roger Hallam and Gail Bradbrook, I think, are the two people that were most closely associated with Extinction Rebellion. These guys really motivated and inspired me and led me to want to work with them and to bring about social change.
Yes, exactly. And so that's why you're featured on this show to talk about the Extinction Rebellion. We're really glad to have you, Allison. I also want to introduce Isabel Ronowski. Isabel just graduated last month from Wellesley College, and she's in here working as one of our spring semester interns. Hello, Isabel. And Hunter Lambert is at Boston University. Hi, Hunter.
Hello, everyone.
Allison, I kind of cut you off, and you were telling us about how the Extinction Rebellion came to be. Tell us about the roots.
It started some time ago, I think, with Gail primarily, who had been an activist and who had been trying to facilitate and encourage mass civil disobedience. And then last year, things seemed to gel. And so in October, on October 31st last year, there was a declaration in London. And this was then followed by a number of events in London. The movement is unusual in that it's grown remarkably quickly, but it has at its core some principles that I think will resonate really with a lot of people. And they're things like telling the truth about climate and the ecological emergency. You know, and I think most people can identify with that because, you know, the truth is absolutely fundamental. You know, what is wrong with telling the truth? A second requirement is that the government enacts legally binding policy measures. And then a third one is that we bring about a citizens' assembly to oversee changes as part of a sort of creating a democracy. And those are the three core principles that I think have really sparked the imagination of a lot of people from academics to young people to grandparents. They're the kinds of things that people can really buy into and really believe in.
Can I just add that the demand for legally binding policy measures, it's the precise demand in the UK context, and I think it would be similar in the US context, is for this country to go carbon net zero by 2025, which is an incredibly bold demand. It looks completely unrealistic according to the rules of the political system as we know it. It requires everything to be changed in a short space of time. But that is actually what we need. This is one of my favorite demands that we in Extinction Rebellion are making. We're saying, yes, everything has to change really fast. And that's why we need to do really radical things to get there. It's not going to happen if we just stick to the conventional political process. It's not going to happen if we just stick to trying to vote for the best candidates at elections. That can help, but it isn't going to get us to zero carbon by 2025. So I think that demand of the Extinction Rebellion really concentrates the mind and really shows why we need to be engaging in mass civil disobedience.
Yes, I'm glad to see that you are quite clear about what kind of strategies to get there in terms of, you're not saying the end justifies any means. You have some discipline. And
so nonviolence is completely central to the movement. And as Alison just said, also, we want democracy. We want real democracy. We're saying that representative democracy, as we know it, has failed. So let's have some citizens' democracy. Let's have some sortition is the technical term for it. It's like what you do with a jury. A jury is selected at random from members of the public. We should have a citizens' assembly like that, where people are selected at random to represent us all, as a jury does. And then they're given some help and some education and some information and facilitated in deliberating about what we should do. Frankly, they couldn't do any worse than the current bunches of politicians we've got in our countries. So let's give that kind of radical version of democracy, let's give that kind of idea a chance.
So that means you have to be open to diverse approaches to getting there. You're not just all walking steps in the same, you know, kind of together. I mean, that you're trying to be a big tent, right, and involve different views and stuff.
Yeah, and you're trying to open to new and radical possibilities. Of course, a lot of what we do is going to have to be done by really, really working together more closely together than we ever have done before. We have to want to do that. We have to do it more or less voluntarily. That's what real democracy means, and that's part of what Extinction Rebellion wants to facilitate, real democracy and nonviolent rule of the people, by the people, for the people.
And we're going to get into that, about how you're really receptive to letting people express it in a local way. Does that, nothing influences local decision makers better than someone who sounds like their mother or, you know, takes the approach that really catches their attention. Oh, over to you, Isabel. I'm going to have a question.
Allison, you mentioned earlier that there were some events organized in London. Can you tell us the first big action taken there as part of the Extinction Rebellion mission and movement?
And for me, this was a first too. So I participated in what we're calling the Bridges event. And this took place on November 17th in London. And, you know, this was a big ambition. So the plan was that people would descend upon London and we would arrange ourselves on five bridges simultaneously. And then when a signal was given, we would then just swarm into the roads and we would just stop. We would simply stop the traffic. And, you know, for a lot of people there, you know, I was there on the day on Waterloo Bridge. I know Rupert was there too. Being there and actually talking with the people about why they were there and their motivations and what mattered to them was, you know, was really quite an incredible experience. You know, the UK hasn't seen this kind of action, this kind of commitment from normal people to simply congregate and to actually take action, non-violent action, in this particular way. We haven't seen this kind of thing in a long, long time. So it was quite an experience, I have to say, you know, to actually just be there and then to look across the Thames, across to the other bridges. The atmosphere was quite euphoric in a way, which sort of seems somehow not quite appropriate for an event that was a very serious event. I mean, these were people who are passionate, absolutely passionate about what's happening in the UK and across the globe, and who are saying, you know, we've had enough. We are going to rise up and we are going to make ourselves heard. It was a very empowering experience from my perspective. And Rupert, I know you were there. Perhaps you want to say something too?
Yeah, well, my experience was very similar. I was on Lambeth Bridge and I was helping to try to sort of organise the taking of the bridge. The atmosphere before we tried to go into the road, frankly, it was pretty nervous. I was really quite uncertain that it was going to work out. And then Roger Hellam, who was on Lambeth Bridge with me, and one or two of the others started walking out into the road. They just started strolling into the road. And then we all started following. And we just found how incredibly easy it was for hundreds of us to occupy this bridge and stop the traffic, bring central London to a standstill, reduce economic activity, and how the police couldn't really stop us because there were so many of us. And as you say, Alison, part of the atmosphere was, as a result of this, euphoria. It's like, wow, we can do it. 6,000 people took nonviolent civil disobedience and occupied the bridges of central London. And if we've done that once, well, we can do it again, and we can do it again on an even larger scale. And that is indeed what we're planning to do in April.
Yeah, and I recommend people go to your website.
The correct website address is simply rebellion.earth.
If you want to follow along with what Allison and Rupert are talking about, it's a great site to visit. Oh, Allison, you had an event that involved burying a coffin?
It did. So November 17th was really a very symbolic event. It was about expressing feelings, expressing anger. The following event on November 24th in Parliament Square was really, it was a grieving event. It was where people came together to talk about their feelings, to talk about how we feel about, you know, the loss of the Arctic sea ice, the loss of so many species. Oh, you know, it's tragic to how we feel about the forthcoming loss of even more species. And Skeena Rathor has been sort of in many ways, you know, the heart and soul of Extinction Rebellion. And she talked very passionately and emotionally about how one of the hardest things she'd had to do was explain to her teenage daughter that she might not have the longevity that she would wish for. And hearing these impassioned speeches from various people, Rupert spoke too, it was incredibly moving. And it culminated in there was a march and there was also a symbolic burial of a coffin. These kinds of actions where people talk about, you know, about feelings, where there's a deep kind of spiritual core to the movement, this is incredibly unusual. This hasn't really been seen before.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think this is a unique dimension of Extinction Rebellion. We're giving people a space which is so needed for the expression of feelings of grief and loss and terror. And these things have been suppressed in the environmental movement far too often. the environmental movement for far too long has said things like, oh, we have to be optimistic. We always have to give people something positive to look towards. And it means that we've been very inauthentic often in the environmental movement. The Extinction Rebellion is blowing through all of that. We're saying, stuff that. Let's be honest. It's time to tell the truth, which is the demand we're also making, as Alison said, of the government. So we had better do it ourselves. It's time to tell the truth about our fears. It's time to tell the truth about our feelings. It's time to tell the truth about what we want. And what we actually find is that liberates people and empowers people to become much stronger and much less fearful. And it leads people, for example, to make the extraordinary, brilliant decision that Alison has made, which has really made me think, I must tell you, of chucking in this amazing job that she has so that she can try to do the right thing for the future of the planet. It's a liberation that's going along with this kind of authenticity and this facing of the reality of what we've done. You know, the horrendous fact that during my lifetime, we have exterminated half of wildlife on Earth. Mind-blowing, terrible fact. If you don't feel really sad when you hear that statistic, there's something wrong with you. So there has to be a place in our movement for that sadness. And in Extinction Rebellion, there definitely has been. And November the 24th, as Alison says, was a superb expression of that. It's called Rebellion Day 2, if people want to look it up on the internet.
I'm tempted to call for a moment of silence, but instead, we have to take a break. And we'll be right back to talk some more with Rupert and Alison about Extinction Rebellion.
Radio EcoShock.
You can also send an email to rob@oceanriver.org. Now, back to Dr. Rob Moyer.
Hi. We're talking, we being Hunter Isabel and I, are talking about the Extinction Rebellion with Rupert Reed and Alison Green, who are calling in from the UK. And Rupert, what's the website for people to learn more about Extinction Rebellion?
The correct website address is simply rebellion.earth.
I think, Hunter, we got a question.
I know we touched on some events earlier regarding the bridge blocking and symbolic burial of Coffin. We also hit on the idea of doing things at a local level. Do you guys want to talk about what Extinction Rebellion is doing with local communities?
Locally, I think it must be around about 200 now Extinction Rebellion groups around the UK, and you know, globally, it's spreading really, really quickly too. Just to give you an example, in Cambridge, which is where I also happen to be, we had an event just before Christmas, which was really quite remarkable. 200 people just congregated in town, and we marched through town, and we did a number of actions. Again, these are all non-violent actions, very symbolic, very moving. We staged a die-in in a large shopping arcade, which is really, really quite something to just sort of lie down on the ground in a large shopping arcade. People haven't seen that kind of thing before, certainly not around here. And then in the market square, we had a number of people, including myself, just talking to people, not just to the people who were part of the action that day, but talking to members of the public too, and trying to say to people, you know, what's happening isn't acceptable. You know, we have to stand together. We have to rise up. We have to take action. We have to make some very simple, basic demands that aren't contentious, asking governments to tell the truth. You know, it's not what they're used to doing. It's what we should be doing. We had the action in Cambridge. We had another one recently where we staged a bike ride. I mean, Cambridge is Cycle City. And this was a bike ride unlike any other, in that we were actually going. I wasn't part of that one on that occasion. And people were cycling very, very, very slowly through town. What I like about these regional events is that they have their own regional identity. People are doing things that are kind of appropriate for their city or where they happen to be. People are being creative. People are thinking about what they can do and how they can make a difference. And, you know, I think, you know, I've used the word empowering before already, but it's incredibly empowering for people to feel that they can do something and then to see that they're making a real difference.
That's my perspective from Norwich, which is very much in line with what Alison's saying. It's important to understand that Extinction Rebellion is quite a decentralist organisation. So local groups, local affinity groups and local groups generally have a strong right to do whatever they want, provided they stay within the overall frame of the principles of Extinction Rebellion, and especially the fundamental method of nonviolence. So where I live in Norwich, we've been very active. We occupied and blocked a exhibition where the local council were trying to promote a horrible new climate dangerous road that they want to build. We non-violently protested there and effectively blocked this exhibition from happening. We've also been working hard to try to persuade our local councils to declare a climate emergency, which is happening as a result of Extinction Rebellion in more and more places around Britain and, in fact, around the world. These local events are happening all over the place, as Alison says, more and more of them. And then there are also going to be the big national and indeed international events, with the key one being on April the 15th, which everyone is working towards.
Right. We'll come back to the April event later in the show when we're urging people to join with, you know, sign up for your website and stuff, because we want to get people involved with that. But before then, I want to talk a bit about, you know, how you guys are working the media to get the word out. Alison, there was a letter from academics that you could maybe start us off on, and then Rupert could comment on that as well.
Yeah, one of the things that I think has been hugely effective in terms of getting Extinction Rebellion on the radar and bringing awareness to it was the initial letter that Rupert, Richard House and I composed. You know, and we composed the letter, and it's a, if you look at it, it's on the Guardian website. It's very visceral, you know, because we are all, the three of us, incredibly passionate about what's happening and what's not happening. And just how important it is that, you know, that action is taken. And so being academics, you know, we thought, well, academics need to have a voice. You know, the public trust, they trust academics, they tend to trust experts. So we reached out to our academic networks across a huge number of different disciplines. So we weren't reaching out simply to climate scientists. We were reaching out to people from the arts and the humanities, sciences and theology, philosophy, you know, a broad church. It was remarkable because, you know, people would, you know, willingly sign up, many of them saying, fantastic, you know, we really support what you're doing. It's about time. We've needed this. And that letter was really a turning point for Extinction Rebellion. It was cathartic. It's proven to be a catalyst. It's had that letter has had some 16,000 downloads, I think, from The Guardian, which is, you know, if you think of it, this is it, in one sense, it's just a letter. In another sense, I think it marked a point at which academics were saying, we are no longer sitting on the fence. You know, we are standing up and we're going to make our voices heard.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we then followed that up with a second letter in December, which was an international letter, which was, again, headed up by Alison and Richard House and myself. And this international letter had a lot of signatories that your listeners will recognize, people like Vandana Shiva, Naomi Klein, Noam Chomsky, Philip Pullman, Bill McKibben, Jonathan Porritt, Lily Cole, Chris Packham, a real retinue of international stars of the Green Movement and of broadcasting and of media and of dissent. And what this international letter did was follow on the initial letter and say, look, this obviously is something of concern to us around the world. And around the world, we need organizations, we need movements like Extinction Rebellion to be taking off in a big way if we are to have a future. It really is as simple and as blunt as that. We're delighted that these letters seem to have had this kind of involving and catalyzing effect upon people. And that's part of the reason, I think, why we are seeing this extraordinary international development of Extinction Rebellion. I think officially now there are groups in 127 countries, which is really quite incredible. And what we're hoping, among other things, is that in the US, Extinction Rebellion is really going to grow and take off in the next few months and hopefully rise to the kind of level that it's already risen to in Britain.
Yes, I see signs of that happening here from my Boston perspective. You guys have really set a great trend. There was a letter with the BBC in London.
I think you might be referring there to the letter that I coordinated, which happened a month or two earlier, where we, a bunch of us, got together to lobby the BBC to essentially say that it's completely inappropriate for them to have a so-called balanced debate between climate scientists and so-called climate skeptics, i.e. climate change deniers. And the BBC then changed their policy, and the BBC have actually moved in the right direction here. And the BBC now say they will no longer feature these kind of climate change deniers as balance. And this obviously is a real step forward. And obviously that's something which you badly need in America, but it's much more difficult for you in America when you have the unfortunate position that your so-called president is himself one of those completely absurd deniers. But hopefully before too long, the US will be catching up with us on that and following the practice of the BBC, which, as I say now, is to not feature climate change deniers anymore. The BBC has accepted the reality of climate change, human anthropogenic, deadly climate change. And this is a significant step forward.
Yes, we had a significant step in Washington just 2 days ago, when now that the Democrats control the House of Representatives, the House Committee on Natural Resources could recognize climate change and had Massachusetts Republican governor, one of the most popular governors in the country, go to Washington and explain how we must address climate change. So that the chairman of that committee was wise enough not to have a Democrat telling Republicans why they should do this, but to have the Republican governor and a Republican representative from Florida, South Florida, to talk about, hey, you know. So, yes, we've got a bumpkin at the top, and fortunately, you know, the Democrats have taken back the House, and that gives us a crowbar into doing this kind of legislation things. Let's kick back a bit, and Rupert, tell us about kind of the philosophical underpinnings of this whole kind of, these kind of endeavors of trying to repair nature and how complicated it all is. And
well, there's so much to say here, but let me just mention a couple of key things. Firstly, as we've already implied, and this is a very important point, the Extinction Rebellion is not just about dangerous man-made climate change. It's not just about climate breakdown. It's about the wider ecological crisis, of which climate breakdown is simply the biggest and most immediately existentially threatening symptom for us, for humans. But we have to remember that actually the extinction crisis and the biodiversity crisis are hitting already the planet unbelievably hard and rendering other species extinct at an almost unprecedented rate. And this is all down to us, and mostly not down to climate, actually. It's mostly down to habitat destruction and sheer human numbers and level of human consumption and production and pollution more generally. Extinction Rebellion is concerned about the possible extinction of the human race and the actual extinction of other beings across our planet. And we want absolutely to stop both of these things. That's the first point. The second point is that part of what is needed in order for us to make this kind of massive shift, this shift in our practices and shift in our mindset, is for us to move to what's called a more precautionary approach, which is what is really called for by proper science and certainly by proper philosophy and proper ethics. And what precaution says is you shouldn't have to wait until all the evidence is in about something terrible that we're doing before you move to act on it. The demand to have full evidence, full proof that things are just as terrible as we say they are, is actually a demand for prevarication. It's actually an excuse for inaction. We need to act ahead of certainty to protect things which are at terrible risk of being destroyed while we try to wait to accumulate the evidence that goes to make up that certainty. And that kind of action on the basis of probabilities, on the basis of our exposure to risk, rather than on the basis of absolute certainty, that is precaution. That is what's known as the precautionary principle. And that precautionary principle is a key part of the motivation for Extinction Rebellion. It needs to be a key part of the way we rethink what we're doing across the whole piece here. And so for that reason, for example, in our first letter, the academic's letter that Alison mentioned, we highlighted the precautionary principle and said, if we really operated on the basis of precaution, if we stopped being so reckless with our common future, well, then we actually would have a chance of reining in the destruction that we're reining at present in time.
Rupert, thank you for taking time away from all your other stuff to tell us about the Extinction Rebellion. Alison, thank you. We've run out of time, so I have to cut you off right there. Thank you very much for spending the time to explain all the good work that you're doing with the Extinction Rebellion.
Thank you. You're all very welcome.
And all you listeners, thank you for listening this week. Please tune in next week. And just take care and take care of yourselves, and then try to take a moment to take care of this planet Earth of ours. Thanks a lot.
Sadly, we are out of time. You can find Rob's full 52-minute broadcast with more from Alison Green and Dr. Rob Muir at oceanriver.org. To get this and other free podcasts, click on radio at oceanriver.org or listen to the Voice America Variety Channel live every Thursday at 12 noon Pacific Time. I hope Greta Thunberg gets that Nobel Peace Prize. Thousands of people in over 100 countries joined her school strike on Friday, March 15th. Now we need the parents to listen and start acting to save our future. We're out of time here on Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
You know, this is just one form of many ways that Israel is tightening its grip on Jerusalem and trying to change the characters of the city so that Palestinians either leave it or are rendered invisible in it.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and this is the Electronic Intifada podcast. With me is my co-host, Asa Winstanley. Asa, how are you?
I'm great. I'm very happy to be here again. I think we're awesome.
Yeah, we're doing pretty well. This is our third episode of the revamped Electronic Intifada podcast. And in a few minutes, we'll go to an interview with our colleague, Tamara Nassar, who's going to talk about some recent brutal home evictions in occupied East Jerusalem, as well as ethnic cleansing operations against Palestinian Bedouin communities. And then she's also going to talk about these very close relationships between Israel and leaders, monarchies, dictators in some of the Gulf states, and why it's important to keep our eyes on those relationships. But first, Asa, what are you reading about, thinking about, reporting on this week?
Well, I've mostly been thinking about and reading about Ilhan Omar. Ilhan Omar did nothing wrong. Ilhan Omar, everything she said was factual and accurate. And if I fault her for anything, it's for apologizing. It really...
Backtrack a little bit and tell us who Ilhan Omar is, if anyone's been stuck under a rock the last week and a half and hasn't seen what's
been taking place. I think we probably will do an episode about this, won't we, at some point, because it's such a big topic. But Ilhan Omar, the new congresswoman who, you know, she's on the left, and she tweeted saying it's all about the Benjamins.
Right. This was in response to Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept talking about how the GOP leader, Kevin McCarthy, was trying to figure out a way to punish Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and also Rashida Tlaib of Michigan for being open about their support of the Palestinian-led campaign for BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And Glenn Greenwald was tweeting about how it's completely absurd and how, you know, the of course he's being supported by Israel lobby interests in trying to punish these two congresswomen. And Ilhan Omar tweeted, well, it's all about the Benjamins, baby, which is a line from a late 90s hip hop track by Puff Daddy.
Yeah. And then when she was asked who is paying people to support Israel, she said, APAC, which is just factually true. Like, so
right.
There.
And who asked her? Who was that person that asked her? It was Bhatia Ungar Sargon, who's the opinion editor for the Forward.
Yeah, and the worst person.
Who then led this tirade against her for using what Bhatia called anti-Semitic tropes, which she couldn't even really back up herself. And it kind of led to this unbelievable pile-on for several
days. Yeah, and then her newspaper then used the incident to raise Benjamins for their newspaper, sending out a fundraising email around, which is the most cynical thing, and which APAC also did. It caused some division, this whole thing. There was a big outcry against her, and there was... she's come under attack from Trump, the arch anti-Semite. And more disgustingly, I mean, because we would expect it from the right, but she's come under attack from Democrats, the Democratic Party establishment. And she was kind of forced, in my opinion, to issue an apology for, you know, the way she tweeted. And the whole thing did cause some divisions on the left, as the whole Labour anti-Semitism hoax has done in the UK.
Right. I mean, that's what was really revealing about this whole avalanche of, of smear attacks against Ilhan Omar, is that it kind of read exactly from the playbook of what racists have been and, you know, racist leaders in the UK have been doing against Corbyn and anyone in the Labour Party who has an inkling of support for Palestinian rights.
Yeah, so the Labour anti-Semitism smear campaign is best understood as a campaign by racists to smear anti-racists as racists. And this is exactly what's happening here. Yeah. You know, you've got... Donald Trump, an arch racist, calling an anti-racist Ilhan Omar a racist, and it's the most disgusting, cynical thing. And you're right; it's exactly the same playbook as what's happened here. It's all the same dynamics, and all the same mistakes are being made. Where there's even people who on the left who are good intentioned, who are saying, well, you know, she was right, but she shouldn't have said it the way she said it. You know, they're saying, oh, well, and.
God forbid she should talk about the financial aspect of what lobbies do. I mean, it was completely it hit a level of absurdity, but it also spoke to this overwhelming pattern of attacks against Black women, Muslims, and anti-racist people who understand that Palestinians are under a violent, you know, apartheid and occupation system that is fully funded by the United States. So it was this combination of so many factors of misogyny and anti-Black racism and Islamophobia, directed at this one congresswoman for stating simple facts about a lobby group on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, what it's doing is actually singling out Israel for special protection. I mean,
something that they accuse everyone else of doing.
It's the only lobby that you're not supposed to talk about as lobbying, as paying people off.
Right,
of course
right.
It pays people off. Of course it does. Yeah. I mean, and then there was several articles afterwards which were kind of supporting her, but saying, oh, well, she was mistaken. Like, there was an article in The Guardian, pro-Israel donors spend over $22 million on lobbying and contributions in 2018. The article, basically, first of the article was like to support her central point and saying, yeah, you know, they do this. But even that article, like, kind of ticked her off. It's supporting the article, the essential basis of it, and in the article quoting from this researcher into lobby groups, and this person is saying, I haven't observed many other countries that have a comparable level of activity, at least in domestic lobbying data. And then the journalist, this Guardian journalist, Tom Perkins, then says, Omar incorrectly suggested AIPAC makes campaign contributions to candidates. However, records show it did spend about $3.5 million lobbying during the 2018 election cycle. Well, you know, this person's there, this right. ticking off Ilhan Omar and getting their facts wrong, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it just, it was an extreme form of gaslighting. Yeah. And the fact that all of these, you know, liberals and, you know, soft Zionists were trying to somehow criticize Omar for saying exactly what was factually correct about Israel, about Israel's lobby groups, while trying not to look as racist as they are, was just it was messy and clunky, and it just revealed exactly what Omar was pointing out, that there is massive influence, inside the halls of power, and by Israel lobby organizations and AIPAC yeah. being an umbrella organization for many lobby groups.
Somehow
we weren't supposed to talk about that.
And some of it even comes from some leftists, which is really infuriating, where they get into this thing where they say, oh, well, actually, I agree with Noam Chomsky, and I think it's down to ideology and blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff. And it's just really stupid, because AIPAC does buy off candidates. It uses dark money to do it. You know, they say, oh, well, I looked on a, you know, I had some idiot, like, with some sort of Marxist Twitter handle, you know, claiming to be a Marxist. But like, they're just ignoring, it's some kind of, you know, it's not a very good Marxist who ignores like objective facts, the objective reality of AIPAC literally buying off people, buying off candidates with dark money. And the, you know, in the Israel lobby documentary, they explained in their own words how they did that, you know.
Right. Right. You know?
They use this. Exactly. They use this kind of off the books money, and they skirt around electoral law, but they That's definitely right. do it. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of absurd to think. You know, the AIPAC, which raises I don't know tens of millions of dollars a year. What are they spending it on, birthday parties for their, you know, for their workers? It's completely absurd. But you know what I thought was also really important to point out was that after 3 or 4 days of being completely bullied and smeared as an anti-Semite and all of this absurd attacks against her, Ilhan Omar then, led, I think, one of the most, anti-war interrogations of one of the most notorious pro-genocide architects of destabilization
Elliot Abrams.
Campaigns. In,
God, it was so damn good.
Who it was, it was amazing. You know, and she, it wasn't even like, you know, very radical questioning. No. She was just like, okay, you lied to Congress in 1991 about your involvement in supplying arms to the Contras. What makes you think that we can trust you now in your efforts at regime change in Venezuela? And I think that was, you know, just that level of, again, laying out the facts and not being apologetic and not compromising in her leadership as an elected lawmaker. That's what we expect our electeds to
do. I love how she just refused to accept this whole idea of, oh, we've got to be civil, you know.
That's right. That's right. And she, I mean, she was dignified. She had integrity. She didn't let Abrams, you know, complete meltdown and hysteria, waver her at all. I mean, this was probably the first time in his life that he had ever been made uncomfortable.
Or even questioned, you know.
Even questioned
on something that actually matters, as opposed to like, you lied to someone who is important. You know what I mean?
Right. And as I pointed out in a blog post that I posted on EI last week, you know, her commitment to anti-racist principles that were exemplified in her interrogation of Elliot Abrams is something that I think the Democrats fear as much as they feared her speaking openly about AIPAC and the Israel lobby influence. Yeah. You know, they don't, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the top Democratic Party leadership, they are gunning for regime change in Venezuela. And when they see, you know, this hotshot, you know, congresswoman, you know, speaking her truth and taking these centers of power into account, holding their feet to the fire, that I think made them nervous to say.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think this goes to the heart of the threat from the left, as they would see it, because what this represents, what Ilhan Omar represents that's new, is an actual challenge on foreign policy. Bernie Sanders has given them a challenge on domestic policy in terms of having some sort of, you know, basic, just, I don't know, not
common sense.
Just like having some sort of healthcare or anything, just common common sense stuff, basically, that you would need in any kind of sort of social democratic government and state. But, you know, he's often, from our point of view, been incredibly lacking on questions of international solidarity. And even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we can say the same about her. But what Ilhan Omar represents is a challenge to that, you know, and not just on Palestine, but the fact that Palestine is this emblematic issue, and the fact that she for international solidarity, and the fact that she's challenging Elliot Abrams, the architect of these American imperial dirty wars in Latin America, is really incredibly inspiring. So. Right. Listeners, everyone, go and read Nora's piece about this. Ilhan Omar takes on the establishment, and, you know, ignore anything else that's out there. Don't read anything else.
This edition of the Electronic Intifada podcast will be continued next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Kavika Martin of Peace Action, who assesses the significance of the U.S. Senate's passage of the Yemen War Powers Resolution and how the vote could exert pressure on the Trump administration and the Saudis to end their bloody war in Yemen. Poe Murray, chair of Newtown Action Alliance, who discusses the recent Connecticut Supreme Court ruling that reinstates a wrongful death lawsuit against gunmaker Remington Arms for the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre. And Kara Ortoliva, lead organizer with the Youth Climate Strike in Connecticut, who talks about the demands of the worldwide youth-led movement pressing government leaders for urgent action on climate change. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Arab Emirates, or UAE, is looking to flex its military muscle in the Persian Gulf and the greater Middle East. Today, Dubai is mostly known for its glitzy skyscrapers, but the kingdom's leaders are looking to establish a powerful presence in a volatile region. With only 1 million people, the UAE has expanded its arms industry and attracted lots of buyers. Former U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis called the small Gulf nation Little Sparta for its growing military clout. After the end of the Cold War, the UAE had a small army, relying on aging equipment and foreign commanders. But amidst shifting political alliances, the Arab Spring, and growing fears of Iran, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed embarked on a plan to modernize the UAE's armed forces, purchasing advanced weapons systems from France and the U.S. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the UAE's military in recent years has enforced the no-fly zone in Libya and sent fighters into Syria to battle Islamic State insurgents. In the Saudi-led, U.S.-backed Yemen war, UAE forces have played a central role in daily missions battling Houthi rebels. However, the Saudi-UAE war in Yemen has been widely condemned for triggering the world's most serious humanitarian crisis, a conflict that has become so divisive the GOP-controlled U.S. Senate recently voted to end American military involvement in Yemen and to curtail President Trump's war powers. Through the early days of the 2020 presidential campaign, Democrats were repeatedly asked about reparations to compensate African Americans for slavery and decades of racism. Several candidates, including Elizabeth Warren and Julian Castro, back reparations without offering a specific plan. When asked about reparations at a CNN forum, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders explained he co-sponsored a bill with Congressman Jim Clyburn to mobilize federal resources in distressed communities. When pressed about reparations by CNN host Wolf Blitzer, Sanders responded by asking, "What does that mean? I don't think anyone's been very clear." The Intercept, which has promoted debate over reparations, says Sanders makes an important point since the agenda for reparations is not very specific. Unlike Medicare for All, reparations are often viewed as a broad progressive value, not a specific policy. Other candidates, including Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, support broad initiatives to support the poor, which is comprised disproportionately by people of color. But neither of the two announced black candidates are pushing race-specific strategies to counter the legacy of slavery and systemic racism. Calls for reparations were ignored in the civil rights era in the 1960s and during the presidency of Barack Obama, the nation's first black president. Expectations were high that public sector unions would collapse after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that workers could opt out of fair share fees to pay for collective bargaining. Months after the historic ruling, public sector unions were doing better than expected, with minimal loss of membership, as union leaders rallied their rank-and-file members. According to In These Times, public favorability of labor unions is at a 15-year high. At major unions like AFSCME and the American Federation of Teachers, workers are signing on as members at five times the rate they are opting out. In Los Angeles, the AFT Local launched a major outreach campaign focusing on teachers, talking up the benefits of collective action. Opposing the Janus decision was seen as a key strategy to defend public education and counter the rise of charter and private schools. In many states, public sector unions are under attack from the same right-wing groups who developed the Janus case. These groups organized aggressive campaigns via email and knocking on doors to convince workers to opt out of unions. Unions say the effort by groups like the Freedom Foundation backfired. Among home care providers in Oregon, new union membership outpaced those opting out by a 3-2 margin. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The U.S. Senate, by a 54-46 vote, approved a resolution calling for an end to U.S. support for the Saudi Arabia-led coalition war in Yemen. Voting for the measure on March 13th were all Senate Democrats, joined by seven Republicans, which put President Trump on notice of growing opposition to the U.S. role in the war, which the United Nations calls the world's most dire humanitarian crisis. 14 million Yemeni civilians are now on the brink of starvation as the nation faces a devastating cholera epidemic. The Senate had approved the War Powers Resolution last December, but the GOP-controlled House blocked a vote at that time. Democrats, who won control of the House in November, passed their own version of the resolution in February. But due to a procedural issue, the House must vote again using the Senate measure's language. President Trump has vowed to veto the legislation
which would require a two-thirds majority vote in both houses of Congress to override. If the vote proceeds as expected, this would be the first time the War Powers Act has been invoked by Congress since the legislation won passage in 1973. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kavika Martin, Senior Director for Policy and Political Affairs with Peace Action. Here, Martin assesses the significance of the Senate's passage of the War Powers Act and growing animosity toward the Saudi monarchy after they murdered Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, which could exert pressure on the Trump administration and the Saudis to end their bloody war in Yemen.
We've been attempting to do this for a number of years, and in the House, at least the last couple of years, the war powers kept getting blocked by Republican leadership using various methods to take what should be a privileged resolution to be able to force a vote on these war issues and deprivileging and doing other tactics to not have votes. But fortunately, now that we have a Democratic-controlled House, they have moved forward with the vote earlier this year, in which we would hope that the Senate vote would actually send the bill to the president's desk. Unfortunately, the Republicans use another tactic for the House version this year, which is something called a motion to recommit. It's like the last chance for the minority party to offer either an alternative or a slight change in the bill. And the Democrats at the time didn't know that this motion, which was specifically a motion to support Israel and to oppose anti-Semitism, which, of course, you know, most people want to be opposed to anti-Semitism. So it was sort of an easy vote. But the Democrats didn't quite realize that what's going to do that the Senate parliamentarian would rule that it would make it was not quite related to the bill and lost the privilege status on the Senate side. So McConnell couldn't bring up the bill, decided he didn't want to bring up the bill on the House side. So we're doing this one more time, hopefully. And this was the vote, as you mentioned, in the Senate is a new bill from the War Powers Resolution, very similar to the one that passed last December. Now that it has passed, with all Democrats voting for it and a couple of Republicans helping out, Collins from Maine, Daines from Montana, Lee from Utah, Moran from Kansas, Murkowski from Alaska, and Paul from Kentucky, and Young from Indiana. And so now it goes one more time to the House, and this time we hope that House members will understand that if we want to send this to the president's desk, it needs to be a clean bill, no amendments, no supporting any motions to recommit, just send it to the president's desk and see what the president does with it.
The outcome that is likely here is that President Trump will veto this bill unless there were a two-thirds majority in the House and Senate to override his veto. Is that the likely course of events here?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe that the House will pass it and that it will get sent to the president's desk. Several times he has threatened to veto it. So it's very likely that the veto will occur. And while that's, you know, disheartening not to see this actually enacted into law, and what basically what the law would do would stop the U.S. support of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen. We have been providing, historically, we're providing refueling of jets. Under pressure, Trump administration did stop that late last year, but we still provide targeting assistance, possible arms sales. We have people on the ground, and not only in Yemen, but in Saudi Arabia, assisting with the war. It would stop this assistance, even though it's not going to be signed into law. We've heard from high-level negotiators in the peace process in the Yemen civil war that these votes and this pressure that's being put on Saudi Arabia is impacting the negotiations in a positive way to move towards a political solution, because that's the only solution that we have here to stop this war. And so we do think that another vote and the attention that the veto will get will continue to put pressure on the Saudi-led coalition to end the war, as well as the rebels inside Yemen. And lastly, it does provide strength to the Congress to move forward on other possible avenues, such as trying to cut off funding for things and other legislative activities that they can do over the next several months. When you have so many millions of people on the edge of starvation, one of the hopes that these votes and the attention that is being put on the situation will put pressure on the parties to work quicker to come to some sort of political agreement. We do know, again, from very high-level people within the negotiating teams that these votes will, they think, will help put pressure to get that political solution, which is the only way to stop the war.
That was Paul Kavika-Martin, Senior Director for Policy and Political Affairs with Peace Action. For more perspectives on the U.S. role in the Yemen war and the War Powers Act, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 14th, the Connecticut Supreme Court handed down a ruling that reinstates a wrongful death lawsuit filed by families of victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting against Remington Arms, the manufacturer of the rifle used in the December 14, 2012 massacre. In their 4-3 ruling, the justices overturned a lower court decision that the lawsuit was prohibited by a 2005 federal law that shields gun makers from liability in most cases when their products are used in crimes. The plaintiffs, who include a survivor and relatives of 9 people killed in the Sandy Hook massacre, argued that the AR-15-style Bushmaster rifle sold by Remington and used by shooter Adam Lanza was irresponsibly marketed and promoted to civilians to carry out offensive military-style combat missions against their perceived enemies. The gunmaker used slogans in their advertising, such as "Consider Your Man" card reissued. Your reporter spoke with Poe Murray, chair of the Newtown Action Alliance, established after the Sandy Hook massacre in her city, who assesses the significance of the ruling handed down by the Connecticut Supreme Court, but first reflects on the March 15th mass shooting in New Zealand, where a white supremacist used a semi-automatic rifle to shoot and kill 50 worshippers at 2 mosques.
You know, the shooting obviously is very similar to many of the tragic incidents that occur in America, and our hearts go out to their community because we know firsthand, you know, what they're going through right now. And, you know, we truly appreciate the fact that their government has vowed to take swift action to change our gun laws. And, you know, we are watching very closely the way they are handling this mass tragedy. The Prime Minister has said that she would support the families that have been impacted by this, you know, horrendous act of terrorism and violence, and we truly appreciate seeing that type of leadership because we don't have that in America.
Oh, I wanted to turn to local issues here, and I wondered if you would comment for our listeners on the Connecticut Supreme Court ruling, which was handed down March 14th, that reinstated a wrongful death lawsuit filed by families of 9 victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. That lawsuit against Remington Arms, the manufacturer of the rifle used in the December 14, 2012 massacre of 26 and 7-year-old children and 6 educators at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, where you are.
Yeah, we are extremely grateful that the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Sandy Hook family because they certainly deserve their day in court to, you know, seek some justice. And hopefully this ruling would be far-reaching. We're hoping that other states could use their own unfair trade practice laws to come to the same conclusion that our Supreme Court did and give the families of victims of gun violence and all the states their day in court as well. But even if that does not happen, the discovery phase of the case will be extremely helpful to expose the gun sellers for some deceptive marketing and distribution and sales strategies of their, you know, very, very lethal weapons for all these years. As we are all aware, the discovery phase of the lawsuits against the tobacco industry helped it
turn the public sentiment, and it forced more accountability from big tobacco. And we hope that this is a step in the right direction to topple the NRA, the NSSS, and other bad actors.
Po, can you talk a bit about the focus of this case, which was on the marketing of these weapons of war to civilian buyers here in the United States, with particular attention to some of the slogans that appeared in many of the ads for guns like the Bushmaster, the AR-15 that was used in the Sandy Hook shooting?
Yeah, so while the NRA and the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is headquartered right here in Newtown, they claim that AR-15s and other weapons, lethal weapons, are not assault weapons. But at the same time, I have seen, you know, the advertisements for these type of lethal weapons. They market them as weapons of war, you know, and that, you know, you will get a man card if you own such a gun. You know, it would be great to be able to look into their marketing strategies to see if, in fact, you know, they have used these deceptive and reckless marketing strategies to put these guns in the hands of very dangerous human beings.
Do you think in the long run this Connecticut Supreme Court ruling will have any impact on the 2005 federal law that immunizes gun manufacturers from civil liability lawsuits brought by victims of gun violence? Because that certainly, this ruling actually targets what could be termed a loophole in that broad federal immunity to gun manufacturers.
Right, that's right. Yeah. So in 2005, Congress passed a Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act called PLACTA. And it really was an unprecedented bill that generally protected the gun industry from a majority of lawsuits with, you know, several exceptions. And it has, it sent a chilling effect for the families and victims. I'll give you an example. One of my good friends, Sandy Amani Phillips, they lost their daughter, Jessie, in the Aurora Theater shooting in 2012. And they decided to sue the online ammunition dealer called the Lucky Gunner that armed their daughter's killer in Aurora. The gunman was able to purchase more than 4,000 rounds of ammunition before the shooting spree without a background check, no questions asked. So they decided to sue the company, and the judge dismissed the case based on that PLACTA law. And the family, Sandy and Lonnie, were forced to pay more than $200,000 in legal fees to the defendants in accordance with the law. So Sandy and Lonnie were forced to file for bankruptcy. And, you know, all they wanted to do was to hold them, you know, accountable for what they did and to, you know, reduce the deceptive actions of, you know, these dealers. And it's just tragic to watch families who lost their loved ones being, you know, victimized again by this horrific law that, you know, protects the gun industry. But we are pushing Congress to take action. And in January, Representative Dwight Evans introduced a bill, H.R. 157, called the Gun Manufacturers Accountability Act. And that will repeal the PLACA, you know, provisions. And before this year, Representative Adam Schiff and our own Senator, Richard Blumenthal, they introduced bills in the 115th Congress to repeal PLACA. And we hope that they will, you know, join our efforts to repeal this terrible law that do nothing to protect these families and our children from gun violence.
That was Poe Murray, chair of Newtown Action Alliance. Find more analysis and commentary on the significance of the Connecticut Supreme Court ruling in the Sandy Hook lawsuit by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 15th, more than a million students walked out of classrooms around the world, calling for emergency action to respond to the climate crisis. They took their cue from teenage Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, who began a one-person school strike last year, protesting every Friday outside the Parliament building in Stockholm. She has since spoken to world leaders in several venues, stating plainly what's at stake for her generation and trying to shame them into action. The statewide event in Connecticut took place outside the Capitol building in Hartford, featuring mostly youth activist speakers, Black, white, and Latinx, who promoted generational, class, and racial climate justice. They talked, for example, about the need to reduce toxic pollution from fossil-fueled power plants that affect low-income people and people of color the most. Several of the young people interviewed said their parents and school officials weren't crazy about the school strike, but many parents ultimately supported their children, and some joined them at the strike rally. After the speeches, participants lined up on both sides of Capitol Avenue with banners and signs where they chanted and drew supportive horn honks and thumbs up from passing cars. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the strike rally in Hartford and spoke with Kira Ortoliva, a senior at a suburban New Haven high school and lead organizer with the state's youth climate strike. Here she explains the climate strike's demands and next steps in the campaign for climate action.
We are calling for the Green New Deal. We're calling for legislative action. Having all of these strikes all over the world, all over countries, we hope that the world leaders will take a look at us and hear what we're saying.
You listed when you spoke before a lot of demands that I would love for you to be able to share as many as you can without any notes right now, if you can.
So we're calling for the Green New Deal. We want to end all infrastructure projects for fossil fuel. We want to keep our water supply clean. We want to preserve wildlife and public land as well. And we want a healthy transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy as well.
You know, the Green New Deal bill was introduced the first day of this session, but it was just a placeholder. There's nothing in it. So people are talking about what should be in it, and all those demands you just mentioned, you think they should all be in it?
Absolutely. I think the Green New Deal should be the first step into tackling climate change head on, because we are at the point in our lives where it's becoming a very serious problem, and by 2040, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish.
So this is a pretty lively demonstration, and I think people did say they were going to be at some point maybe lobbying members of the legislature here. What other kinds of actions do you think are necessary in terms of dealing with, you know, that are commensurate with the level of the problem?
So what we can do is economics. Economics is a big part in this, because we as citizens, we are consumers, and we buy from the companies who are contributing the biggest to climate change. Now, these companies such as Quaker Oats, Charmin, Exxon, all of these companies, mostly gas companies as well, they're fracking, they're contributing to deforestation, and they're taking away animals' homes. And it's one of the leading causes in why some animals are going extinct and endangered. So changing your lifestyle is a very, very big way to help climate change.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, we as Americans, we have an everyday thing where, you know, we go to Dunkin'. Dunkin' has a saying, America runs on Dunkin'. Now, the unfortunate part about it is that some people will go to recycle their Dunkin' cups. Now, this is just an example, but you cannot actually recycle the lids and the straws of the Dunkin' cups, and they need to be washed out before they are recycled. And a lot of people don't understand this, and this is what causes the problems in recycling companies, because if there's any piece of food in your recycling bin, it contaminates the entire bin. And a lot of people don't understand or know that.
So what would you say is the next step after this? And you're probably going to be, as soon as you get a chance, checking on how things have gone all over the country, right?
Yes, absolutely. I'll be hopping onto my national team's group chat in a bit. But the first step that we're going to take after this strike is my co-leads and I, and anyone who would like to join to support, we're going to be lobbying some bills. and we're going to try and put them in motion, as well as the Green New Deal. And our next U.S. Youth Climate Strike will be held on May 3rd.
That was Kira Ortoliva, lead organizer with the Youth Climate Strike in Connecticut. Learn more about the youth-led movement and its demands by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KGHI in Westport, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Killer invades a set of Muslim mosques and commits a massacre of men, women, and even children. The young man publishes a maniacal manuscript decrying Muslim invaders of Europe while slaughtering Muslims at prayer and in meditation. Online, millions view this carnage live as it happened in Christchurch, a city in New Zealand. The author of this horror was reportedly a white nationalist who expressed, opposition to Muslim immigrants. New Zealand, a nation mostly composed of two islands in the Southeast Pacific Ocean, is mostly white people from Britain who number in the millions. The Maori, indigenous people who are of Polynesian ancestry, have lived there for at least 500 years before European arrival, with the 18th century exploitations of British Captain James Cook. As a result of European Maori warfare, Maori were reduced to less than 100,000 people. Today, 200,000 Maori survive. So who are the invaders? New Zealand now has a population of about 4.5 million, 71% of which are of European ancestry. Kind of makes you wonder again, who invaded whom? At last count, some 50 Muslims were slain, and an Australian man in his 20s is charged in connection with what we call the Christchurch Massacre. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Bias and juvenile justice. It's a well-known but rarely acknowledged fact that many federal and state judges are biased and hostile against incarcerated pro se litigants, meaning prisoners like myself who can't afford a lawyer, and so we are forced to represent ourselves in court because them opportunists and capitulists over at PLS refuse to assist us. So we have to go up against the Attorney General's office alone, even though the AG's office has vast resources and manpower. I honestly don't see how this is fair or serves the interest of justice. Then we have to deal with judges who automatically give favor to the AG's office and believe all manners of bullshit the AG office sells them. Let me give you one glaring example. I filed in state court two substantially similar petitions challenging two separate misbehavior reports I received in 2017 at Wendy Correctional Facility in Alden, New York. The misbehavior reports where in retaliation for complaining about the abuse and mistreatment I was being subjected to by prison staff. I mean, Correction Sergeant Roberts assaulted me for looking at his name tag. I so badly wanted to hit this fat piece of shit back because I did nothing wrong, and he's well known for being abusive. Instead, I told myself to seek redress through the grievance process, which is supposed to be designed to address and resolve prisoner complaints. Yeah, right. Instead, I was harassed and frequently subjected to cell searches and drug tests. I don't even use drugs and have no documented history of drug use, and I was placed on an invalid mail watch, which led to the two misbehavior reports. So, this mail watch, the facility was reading all of my incoming and outgoing mail and found some innocent, innocuous letters to write me up for and place me in solitary confinement. I often inspired this kind of overkill and excessive reaction for daring to speak up. Anyway, I won one of the petitions, both of which make the same challenge to the mail watch. Although the same AG's office answered both petitions, they decided to play a little dirty trick and say they couldn't decipher the other petition, claiming it was defective. I want to remind you that both petitions were so substantially similar that they were exactly the same word for word, except for a couple dates and charges. See, the AG's office knew it had one of these judges who'd believe anything they say and largely ignore my arguments. The other petition was decided by a different judge, Christine L. Reiber, but the other judge, Jonathan D. Nichols, decided to let the AG office do his thinking and dismiss my petition. I filed a motion for renewal and re-argument showing Judge Nichols how Judge Reiber's granted a substantially similar petition. Again, he ignored the facts and denied the motion. So, I was forced to expend money I don't have to file an appeal in a brief. And guess what happened? The AG office admits to the appellate court that my petition shouldn't have been dismissed, that my petition wasn't defective, but that they should be given another bite at the apple, despite their dirty trick having my petition dismissed in the first place. See, this is how DOC is able to hide the abuse and mistreatment of prisoners. We can't afford the expense to fight off frivolous and malicious tactics by the AG's office, and judges who are supposed to recognize this disadvantage often don't protect prisoners. This is the kind of injustice I'm facing in my federal lawsuit in the Northern District of New York before Judge Thomas J. McAvoy. Remember, in this lawsuit, I raised a claim that juvenile and youthful offenders have a constitutional right to rehabilitation. Judge McAvoy dismissed this claim, ruling there's no constitutional right to rehabilitation programs in prison. Yet, the United States Supreme Court in Graham versus Florida said a state must give juvenile offenders, and I quote, some meaningful opportunity to obtain release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation, end quote. How can you expect a juvenile offender to demonstrate maturity and rehabilitation in an adult prison if there exists no right to rehabilitation programs in that prison? That makes absolutely no sense. This is especially true since research shows prison negatively impacts the behavioral and cognitive development of prisoners under 25 years old due to their immature brains, which often affects their future behavior. So if a juvenile and youthful offender don't have a right to rehabilitation while in prison, then prison will, I repeat, will graduate them deeper into criminality. I appealed Judge McAvoy's order, which is costing me $505 on top of the $350 I already owe for initiating this lawsuit. Astonishingly, the Second Circuit dismissed my appeal, ruling that it lacks an arguable basis either in law or in fact. I couldn't believe this. The Second Circuit wouldn't even hear my appeal. But my question is, where are all you so-called raise-the-age and juvenile justice advocates? Tune in next time as I discuss this matter more. This is Dante S. Mitchell, better known as Infile Mesa Kibu, reporting to you from Great Meadow Correctional Facility in Comstock, New York. Follow me on Facebook at Free Dante Mitchell. Thank you for listening, and God bless.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a very important show for you today. In a lot of ways, it's all about ringing the bell, blowing the horns, and calling attention to what's happening in this country under the rule of Donald Trump. When Trump first came into power, we sounded an alarm about the threat of fascism in the form of the Trump regime and the need for people to stand up and stop it before it has the chance to consolidate its rule and unleash unthinkable horror on the world. More than 2 years later, Trump is still in power, and it should be clear for all with eyes to see that this can only bring immense horror and suffering on the people here and worldwide. Those who have stepped up against this regime are courageous, but still, the tide of opposition needed to stop these Nazis has not mushroomed in the way that it is needed if fascism is going to be defeated. As should be clear, there are no politicians willing to really take on the Trump regime. The Democrats have done nothing to stop this murdering machine. Indeed, Nancy Pelosi, the reigning leader of the Democrats in the House of Representatives, has gone so far as to declare that instead of driving out this regime, we should all just ignore him and wait for the next election. Sisters and brothers, this kind of capitulation to fascist rule cannot be tolerated. If we fully understand what is happening and what it means for humanity, we have an obligation to humanity to do all we can to stop this regime and its consolidation of fascist rule. We're going to speak about this topic today, what it has in common with the Nazi regime in Germany that led to war and unspeakable horrors, and what this has in common with what we see growing in the U.S. today. At the back end of the show, we'll be listening to an interview I did a while back with Claudia Kunz, an historian of Nazi Germany and the author of numerous books on fascism, including Mothers in the Fatherland and the Nazi Conscience. And we'll be talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on what has developed and taken root in the U.S. and the very real threat that an all-out Nazi regime is fighting to firmly establish itself here. And before that, we'll hear from Bob Avakian on the Democratic Party, a major instrument of this monstrously oppressive system. Before that, we'll be listening to a song about the police murder of Eric Garner, a black man who was strangled by New York police for selling loose cigarettes in Staten Island. Eric Garner was savagely beaten and strangled, even as he cried out, "I can't breathe." In the years since that murder, more than 2,000 people have been murdered by the police around the country, and those are just the ones we know about. Most recently, two young black men were shot down by the police in California for simply being a young black man. Stephen Clark was gunned down in his grandmother's backyard in March of 2018. And in February of 2019, six police in Vallejo, California, shot 20-year-old Willie McCoy as he lay sleeping in his car in a Taco Bell parking lot. Sisters and brothers, this is genocidal. We all have a responsibility as human beings to stop it. And in that spirit, I want to play a song titled "I Can't Breathe," written and recorded by family members of Eric Garner, the man who was murdered by the New York City police in 2014. And opening the show up, we will be talking with historian Peter Fritchie.
I am very pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. He's historian Peter Fritchie, who's the author of Life and Death in the Third Reich and Iron Wind, Europe Under Hitler. And one that really knocked me out is Germans into Nazis. And we're talking about how ordinary Germans became supporters of Hitler and the Nazis and complicit in unspeakable horrors. Peter, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Michael. Thanks.
Yeah, let's jump right into it, man. Let's talk about how Germany became a fascist country ruled by a brutal dictator for more than 10 years. You know, and it's interesting because when people talk about this, we were talking earlier, when people talk about this, there's references to some kind of trickery that enabled all this to happen. But he did actually win an election that people voted in, right?
Well, he did. And there's two extraordinary events that happened in the early 1930s. One is the huge rise of the votes for Hitler between 1930 and 1933. And in the parliamentary system, he topped out at 37%, coming from nowhere. That's a huge number. And that gave him a kind of democratic legitimacy. Moreover, he had a press empire. He had thousands of supporters. He had paramilitary troops. So he had real political power that was visible to almost all Germans by 1932, 1933. But he didn't have everybody. There are millions of socialists, millions of communists, millions of Catholic voters who are not necessarily for Hitler. But within 100 days of the last election in Germany in March 1933, he had completely dismantled democracy, prohibited all political parties, and was riding a wave of popular enthusiasm that historians today are still trying to understand. It was a grassroots movement. It was not funded by big business. It had its ups and downs, and we have to understand why it went up. But this was definitely a democratic movement for pursuing anti-democratic ends in an extremely resolute way.
You know, one of the things that's really, I think we really have to dig into, because it's sort of, you know, you can see it happening now on another level, but at this point, but it actually has a lot of potential for repetition here. And the whole point of this popular myth around how Nazi rule of Germany was imposed, you know, you've argued in your books that there was actually a reason why Germans became Nazis.
There is a factor of imposition. You did imprison tens of thousands of socialists and communists in 1933, but this is a popular movement. Nazism was popular because it was different. It wasn't a big business party. It was not associated with middle-class interest groups. And it was not associated in the minds of its voters with socialism, communism, and internationalism. It was a third way that combined, in the minds of Nazi voters, social progressive policies that would invite workers back into the nation, but would also think Germany first, that Germany had been humiliated at the Treaty of Versailles, and it needed to gather all its national energies in order to act on the international stage and recover economically. So the name of the Nazi party is NSDAP, and that means National Socialist German Workers Party. That acronym is basically the explanation for why the Nazis were able to profile themselves as a new and different force, especially in economically bad times when people were rejecting what they called the system in droves.
You know, one of the things that really troubled me is when I'm reading this and I'm studying this stuff and reading your books, and I keep thinking, in addition to the people who were like really jumping into the Nazis, you know, and loving the Nazis, others remained supportive, but actually they liked the new society, but they didn't like the Nazis, and that they sort of managed to find some kind of common ground where they became, involved in everything that the Nazis were doing on the ground in the country at the time. And this actually means that they accepted a lot of the stuff that was the buildup to, and pretty quickly, the horrendous stuff, the unspeakable stuff that was done by the Nazis.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I make a distinction between Nazis and the Third Reich. And you could love the Third Reich. You could support the National Revolution in 1933, but not necessarily like the Nazis down the block. And in a dictatorship, it's much easier for corrupt, nepotistic local leaders to be quite powerful. And there's no doubt that lots of Germans mistrusted the local brown shirts in the neighborhood. But the big revolution, the National Revolution, as it was called, and the larger project of building a Third Reich, of healing the divisions of German history, of creating a sort of an ethnic consciousness that would make Germany strong again, both inside and outside its borders, that was indeed widely accepted and won increasing assent. And indeed, in 1945, many, many Germans blamed the Nazis for betraying and destroying the Third Reich.
Peter, tell me this. There's actually, at the same time as you're talking about all this, this point about people themselves turning a blind eye at best and sometimes actually justifying a lot of horrendous things that the Nazis ended up doing. And this was especially in relation to Jewish people. Reading your books, I sort of got a sense of like, okay, but people turned a blind eye to this and then sometimes even sort of welcomed it as, you know, necessary. Let's talk about that a little.
Germans had a deep desire for a unified and peaceful and affluent community, but they understood, and this is what the Nazis drove home, and this is the myth that they won. Something happened in 1918 when Germany lost the war. It was betrayed from within, and the only way you're going to get your affluent, peaceable ethnic community is to slay the enemies that betrayed you in 1918. Who exactly those enemies were, people differed. It could be communists, it could be the Jews, it could be someone else. But they understood that there had to be eradication, cleansing, violence in order to reach the desired community imagined in the golden ages of the past, but also then projected onto the future. So there was a willingness to accept ruthlessness, and a willingness to say, well, we can't have Judeo-Christian morality. We have to think as Germans and determine our actions on the basis of what helps Germany. Never before in modern history have people so identified their individuals with the body of the nation. And thinking like that means if you think in terms of betrayal, if you think in terms of a Germany that somehow was lost but could be regained, then you have to move against the betrayers. You have to move against the treason. That was the communists, and that was the Jews. People were complicit in accepting Nazi violence. I don't think the Germans would have voted for the Holocaust, but they accepted the exclusion of people who had previously been considered German citizens because they had an ethnic-based idea of the German future. And this proceeded extraordinarily quickly. Within weeks of when the Nazis won their last elections, people became experts on the Jewish question. How many percent of Jews should be lawyers, should be doctors? Had Jews proven themselves in World War I? However you framed the question, the Jews were different. And that was the first step, the violent exclusion of people who were otherwise your neighbors. Simply by saying Heil Hitler instead of good day, you changed everyday interactions. And so the exclusion of Jews from German life, what's called the Cold Pogrom, happened as much from below as it did from regime proclamations. And it wasn't necessarily at first a brutal violence, but it was the exclusion of your Jewish neighbors from the newly defined German community. And people wanted the Third Reich, and therefore were willing to accept, even if they did think that there were what they called excesses, were willing to accept them because they thought in ethnic terms and the Jews were on the other side.
So that was sort of a level of complicity in it, even if they didn't think that that was it. And in your book, Life and Death in the Third Reich, you talk about how a lot of towns, a lot of cities where Jews would disappear and or they would be people would see them getting on the trains or being trucked out, and then they would rush to get their belongings or, you know, buy their belongings at a local flea market or take over their apartments, which is a level of complicity that is sort of astounding.
It's extraordinary. Now, of course, most people weren't involved in that, but a lot of people were. The fact that Jews were being deported in the fall of 1941 and then again in the spring and summer of 1942 was known. Then, often visibly, the Jews were brought to the train stations via buses or marches or on the streetcars. The apartments were then empty, and auctions were held, and auctions were advertised in the newspapers. And then people, you can read this in the diaries, had to make decisions whether they were going to buy Jewish linens and sleep in them or whether they weren't.
There's some chilling comparisons with the current Trump-Pence regime in the U.S., and anybody who's listening to the show has to have thought that well before I just said that, with regard to immigrants and oppressed nationalities, you know, deportations, arrests, demonization, police terror, et cetera. Let's talk about that.
I ask my students when I teach my Holocaust class, we say, why were people not outraged back then? What outrage is happening to us today that our grandchildren will say, why weren't you outraged? And I have two answers. One is our huge prison population and the willingness to see illegal immigrants and their families being torn apart. You go to El Paso, you go to Nogales, you go to the border towns. People are scared. People are being taken because they're presumed to be illegal. And illegal under the new administration means also probably more criminal. And that means you're assigning evil features to a collective group. This is very dangerous. More dangerous is the idea that somehow we lost America, that America was somewhere in the past, was great, but it hasn't been, but it could be again. That means your enemies are small in number, but sinister, and you have to get rid of them. If only had we not done these and these and these things, that creates internal enemies. And that kind of thinking is extremely dangerous, that there was a wholesome America, and now we're going to get it back. And we're going to get it back by eliminating or getting rid of or somehow undoing the harm between then and now.
Mm-hmm.
And does that mean getting rid of civil rights? Does that mean getting rid of simple empathy when we talk about 11-year-old children or 15-year-old children or 17-year-old children who were perhaps not born in this country but belong in it? It's a whole question of how you define belong.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening.
Yeah.
And if you change the definition of belonging, you're policing that new border.
Wow. Yes, absolutely. Peter, one more question. When I first approached you about coming onto the show, I wrote to you and told you what I wanted to talk about on this first edition because you are going to be back in about 2 weeks, I think. But I approached you about it and told you what I wanted to talk about. And you wrote back to me, remember this, no one could save Jews in 1942 in front of the gates of Auschwitz. You could only save those who would later, and at that point unknowingly, be murdered if you accepted refugees in 1938. That is poor, non-English speaking, possibly communist refugees. And that, of course, was unacceptable and not done. Let's talk about that.
It was not done, and you can look at the Acts of Congress. So we all would vote. We would all say, no, don't gas people in Auschwitz, of course. You're not saving people from the gates of Auschwitz. You're saving homeless, persecuted, lonely, scared people in 1938 with all of their foibles. They're called refugees, and they could be us.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Syria 10 years ago. I never imagined, could never imagine this. And now, so many millions of the people in that country, perhaps people I met, have no home and no future.
All right, Peter, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Yeah, and talk to you again in about 2 weeks.
Look forward to it.
Me too, man. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with historian Peter Fritschi, and we've been talking about basically the situation in Nazi Germany and the parallels it has to what's going on here today as well. What happened there? How did that actually happen? It's not a mystery. You can actually uncover the causes of all this and look and compare with what's happening in this country today, what's being done.
Took my brother and I can never get another one. I'm tired of a system that will never love me. A system that took my brother from me. No matter how much money I receive, I can hear my brother crying. I can't breathe.
I can hear my brother.
Even as fascism continues to consolidate its rule, we are told not to worry, to just go about our lives and close our eyes to the horrors unfolding before us. And while the fascist Trump regime continues to hammer down its rule, we are told that if we want to stop this regime, we should work with and rely on the Democratic Party. Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, described the Democratic Party as a major instrument of this monstrously oppressive system. This is an excerpt from one of his recent talks, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. You can find this entire talk at revcom.us.
From everything that has been said so far, it should be clear why the fundamental change that is needed cannot be brought about by voting. Of course, those who care about and are determined to do something about oppression and injustice are constantly bombarded with the notion that it is crucial to vote for the Democrats because at least they sometimes say they care about this. And this has become all the more intense and insistent with the rise to power of the Trump-Pence fascist regime and its backing by the politicians of the Republican Party, which has itself become a fascist party at its core. It is crucial to vote for the Democrats, they tell us, in order to do something to limit the harm Trump can do. The leaders of the Democratic Party refuse to say that Trump should be removed from office now, and they insist that even talking about that only plays into Trump's hands. But because of the way the electoral system has been set up from the beginning of this country, with the Electoral College instead of direct popular election of the presidents, and small states having as many senators as states with much larger populations, all of which, by the way, was part of the compromise with the slave states, and which represents today the continuing legacy of slavery. And with the way elections for Congress have been manipulated through suppression of the votes of especially black people and Latinos, as well as the gerrymandering of districts, that is structuring them in ways that are geographically distorted, so that people who intend to vote against the Republicans are concentrated in a few voting districts, while those, especially conservative white people, who would vote Republican are spread out through a number of such districts, giving them a greater disproportionate number of congressional representatives. Because of all this, it is far from certain that in the upcoming midterm elections, the Democratic Party will be able to pull off its blue wave to regain a majority in Congress. And what is the approach of the Democrats in attempting to achieve this? To a large degree, it is to run candidates and campaigns they hope will appeal to Trump voters, including candidates who boast of their service in the U.S. military, carrying out bombing raids and other devastation in the Middle East and Afghanistan. The truth is that not only is it necessary to overthrow the system in order to put an end to what is concentrated in the five stops and the horrific conditions to which the masses of humanity are subjected in a world dominated by this system of capitalism and imperialism, but even short of revolution, even in order to prevent the Trump-Pence regime from further consolidating its rule and more fully implementing its fascist program, it is necessary to rely not on the Democratic Party, but on masses of people, breaking out of the confines of politics as usual and carrying out sustained, nonviolent mass mobilization to drive out this fascist regime. In fact, a major role of the Democratic Party is corralling and domesticating dissent. For example, at the time of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, when there was a massive outpouring of opposition to that war, the Democratic Party as such was not in a position to co-opt and derail this dissent because, with some exceptions, Democrats in Congress voted for this war. So they utilized the organization Move On as a kind of oppositional force whose main role was to lure people who were alienated by the war and by the Democratic Party's support for the war back into politics as usual, back into the framework and confines that had produced that war in the first place. More recently, the Democratic Party and those aligned with it have done the same thing with regard to the anger and disgust that literally tens of millions feel toward Trump. And in some ways, the Democrats have actually positioned themselves to the right of Trump, especially in their insistence that the basic problem with Trump is that he is undermining America's dominant position in the world, when in reality, the America First actions of the Trump-Pence regime are aimed at increasing that domination in ways that represent a grave threat to humanity. In case there were a need for further evidence of what the Democratic Party is really about, here are two other striking examples. At the Democratic Party convention in 2016, former CIA head Leon Panetta and Marine General John Allen, a former commander of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, were featured speakers. And when some people at the convention responded by chanting, "No more war," they were met by attempts of the convention officials to silence them, and then they were drowned out by the mainstream of the Democratic Party delegates bellowing, "USA! USA! USA!" And it's just as ugly as that. And let's not forget that when black youth in Baltimore rose up in righteous rebellion after the police murdered Freddie Gray, Barack Obama denounced these youth as thugs. But he never denounced the police who killed Freddie Gray
as murdering thugs. I could go on and on. There is more than a mountain of evidence that shows the actual nature and role of the Democratic Party as a major instrument of this monstrously oppressive system. But there is an even more basic problem. The truth is that the governing politicians, the owners and operatives of the multi-billion dollar media of various kinds, and others who sit atop the major institutions of this society are the political and cultural representatives of this system. Just listen to them when they talk about the role of the U.S. empire in the world. It is our interests, our military, our allies, and on and on and on. And the deeper truth is that it would be impossible for them to be anything other than representatives and functionaries of this system. This is why even stubborn efforts by well-intentioned people to turn the Democratic Party into a positive force are bound to fail. Once again, we are back to the economic relations and the operation of the economic system, the social relations bound up with this, and how this determines the character of the political system and the dominant culture. If the political system operated in conflict with these underlying relations, the society could not function. For this fundamental reason, political parties, which have a major role and influence in this society, are and could only be ruling class parties. Representatives of the ruling capitalist class, instruments of this system of ruthless oppression, administrators and enforcers of a worldwide empire of exploitation and plunder, responsible for massive destruction and devastation of countries and people, and posing a very real and growing threat to the very existence of humanity through environmental destruction or nuclear annihilation.
Once again, that was Bob Avakian speaking on the Democratic Party and the danger of trying to rely on them in the fight against fascism. And now we'll be hearing an interview I did with Claudia Kunz. Claudia Kunz, who is a historian of Nazi Germany, she teaches at Duke University. Claudia, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Let's first talk about how, in broad strokes, your book, you pick it up and you start reading it, and it's very difficult to put it down. And it's very difficult to sit there and not, like, have your bones chilled as you're reading it, when you're looking at this and you're saying, how the hell did this happen? So in broad strokes, let's talk about how fascism developed in Germany.
Okay, first of all, let's remember that nobody ever heard of Hitler until the early 30s. He was unemployed. The only steady job he ever had in his life was when he fought in World War I for 4 years. He was quite brave. This was a splinter party. In 1928, as late as 1928, 10 years after the defeat in World War I, the Nazis got 2.6% of the vote. 1930, they got 18% of the vote. 1932, they were up to the high point ever, 37.4% of the vote. So the Nazis never were voted into power. Hitler was appointed into power. So the question is, how did this disreputable fringe party of loudmouth, brawling stormtroopers get from a tiny splinter party to the center in 1932, which put Hitler in position to get appointed as chancellor, because he was like the prime minister, there was a president above him. Okay, what happened was the Great Depression. Suddenly, one-third of all Germans were unemployed. The government was in gridlock. People were desperate, and Goebbels, Hitler's sidekick for media, had an important insight. He said, we can use democracy to kill democracy. We come, this is a famous statement, we come like wolves to the sheepfold. We will take over. And so that's the crucial thing to look at. What happened between 1930 and 1934 that landed Hitler in a position where he was prime minister, chancellor? And part of that answer has to do with the incompetence and the cluelessness of his opponents, who didn't think he was very dangerous until too late. And also, one thing I should remind you of is that the Germans were educated. Their voter turnout was above 88% all the way through the whole Weimar Republic. These were smart people. And Hitler was appointed chancellor January 1933. Still didn't have a majority. He had to get a majority. Then what happened is the Reichstag burned down. It would be like the Congress, the House of Congress, was burned down. The fire was sufficiently bad. Hitler blamed it on the communists. He called the representatives to the Reichstag, kept communists out, and this time there was another election, the national election. Hitler still only got 44% for the Nazis. And finally, in the middle of March 1934, the government, that is, the politicians, did what the people didn't. The politicians caved in and voted Hitler as chancellor. And from that point forward, he just moved so fast, nobody caught up to him.
You know, it kind of models and reminds you of what happened with Trump and the way he got put into office.
Right. So it'll be from completely outside. The outsider has so much credibility just because of their incompetence, because of their lack of experience.
Then you have the Electoral College that actually had some kind of role to play in, like, looks like we're going to put this guy in because we want him.
We are in a lot more trouble constitutionally than Germany was. Germany had a great constitution.
In the book, you talk about the road to Auschwitz was paved with righteousness, and I thought that was an important point for people to think about.
Right. Ordinary people can't do evil unless they see it as good, unless they see it as protective. So until the 1980s, the Germans said, oh, we didn't know anything about it. Then they said, well, maybe people knew about it, but just an evil, you know, a few bad apples. Then the next question, well, maybe they were just like robots. And I wrote my book, actually, The Mothers and the Fatherland, in this one, to point out that you can't deport from Nazi-occupied territories. You can't have Germans deporting 675,000 other Germans that who were Jewish and unwanted without a lot of collaboration at the local level. And people have to believe that what they are doing is protective because they believe they're in such great danger, like in a wartime. That's the question. How people feel righteous and good when they do the very evil thing of sending friends and neighbors, betraying friends and neighbors at the grass level.
It's
collaborating in the actual killing site.
And it's heavy because it's something that gets repeated throughout the entire history of that regime. It's very, very heavy, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, too. But your title of the book is Nazi Conscience, and you begin it by saying that Nazi conscience is not an oxymoron. But as I was telling you earlier, it kind of made my head snap, because, and to many people, the words of Nazi and conscience are never conceived of as two words that would go together anywhere.
We're so naive, we believe that there's a universal conscience, like thou shalt not kill and do unto others. But actually, when you think about it, Freud had this insight, too. He said it's hard to do unto others who are not like yourselves. And that reminds me of a Nazi slogan, do unto others as you would like others to do unto you. But in the German, it's clearer. Others are people like you. Do unto others who are like yourself.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and a Nazi Conscience. And we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. There's another point that you raise in this, which is, again, really struck me. You quote Carl Schmitt. And he was a big Hitler supporter. He denounced the concept of universal human rights when he was questioned about that. And he denounced it by saying, you know, listen, not every being with a human face is a human. And you say that this statement, which just sort of makes your head spin, you say that this is the bedrock of Nazi morality. What do you mean?
What I mean is Schmitt didn't think Jews had a human face. He looked at their faces. The visual is so important. He looked at their faces and he said, these people are subhumans. There are also people who are racially, well, they're disabled, but he said these people are not worthy of life. Life unworthy of living was a Nazi medical belief. And so they were able to sense whole categories of human beings outside of the realm of moral obligation. Let me give you an example. A young man in the eighth grade, in 1938, he saw his best friend Heinz being taken off in 1938, being taken off to a concentration camp. It was his best friend. Heinz and he grew up together. And he said, looking back, his name was Philip, he said, You know, when I saw them taking Heinz, I didn't say, isn't it terrible they're taking Heinz? He said, isn't it a shame that Heinz is a Jew? That's what happened to his conscience. And he grew up later, came to this country, he wrote a book, and he recognized his ways. But that was his view.
When you're talking about that, it's kind of heavy because it's like this point about a normalization that grew up around fascist rule in Germany. And it lasted quite some time. But I keep wondering, how the hell did this happen? There's all these people, like you said, there's these people who thought this, they thought that, they recognized what Hitler was saying, but they thought that it was part of their moral stand or whatever, and that it was something that was okay to be doing for the interests of Germany. How did this happen? And what was this normalization around fascist rule in Germany up until 39? What actually made that work?
Well, let's think about one of the reasons it worked is because Hitler engineered an economic recovery. Hitler understood that he needed experts in his cabinet, for example. His first cabinet had 12 members and only 3 were Nazis. And the genius behind the economic recovery was actually a founding member of the German Democratic Party. And he was a Keynesian. They borrowed tremendously. And here was his formula. Massive rearmament, because Germany had been disarmed after World War I, infrastructure development, lots of big construction projects, and then labor-intensive projects to give people jobs, like the WPA in the United States. And so all that was going on. By 1936, there was no more unemployment. 3 years, unemployment went from 30% to zero. And all this time, Hitler's diplomatic corps, who were extremely skilled, were being appeased by the West. So Hitler was going from one diplomatic victory to another. And so the combination of domestic rebuilding and international prestige made Hitler very popular. And let's also remember, the Germans read Hemingway. They loved Gone with the Wind. They read Faulkner. They drove Fords. They drank Cokes. They went to church. Germans got the first paid vacations of any workers in the world. They went to mass motels and cruise ships. Just the very first week of Nazi power, just for example, and how important the psychology was, the Nazis were geniuses at this. People in small towns that were buildings were looking kind of shabby got free house paint if they repainted the outside of their houses just so it looks better. That's what normalization looked like. And so people then had a kind of yes-but attitude. Yeah, the Nazis are terrible, but look what they did. So there was a record of real achievement that is hard for us to remember, but it was real.
Now, Claudia, let's talk about this. Who was the actual social base for the Nazis and Hitler, and why?
Yeah, first of all, the Germans keep very good records, so we know how every little district voted for the whole 13 years before the Nazis took over. They even tabulated male and female votes separately. How did they do that? They had women vote on white slips and men vote on gray slips. So we have an exact knowledge of who voted for Hitler. And who voted for Hitler, we would call today the left behind. The people who felt that they were not getting a fair share, that the cities were booming, that the wealthy people were doing okay despite the Depression. They had been through a terrible inflation in 1923. They felt they lost everything. These were the left behind. But the other thing we know, because we have such good voting records, is we say, okay, look at the Nazi Party vote increase, and we can see what parties, and there were 5 major parties, which parties lost votes to the Nazis before 33, and who held their own. The parties that held their own votes were the Socialist parties, the Catholic parties, and the Communist parties. These 3 parties were parties that we can't even imagine today because they were subcultures. They had sporting events. They had singing events. They had paramilitary marching. So these 3 categories of voters did not switch their votes for Hitler. We know that women, first-time voters, that is young women and young people, disproportionately voted for Hitler, but a majority of women never voted for Hitler. But that last-minute bandwagon effect was fueled in part by people who'd never voted before, that is young people and women. So that's before 33. After 33, when it became clear that the Nazis would be in power for some time to come, and remember, the Nazis right from the beginning were arresting communists, they were arresting people who spoke out against them. The first concentration camp in Dachau was set up in 1933 right away, and suddenly the Nazis became the real party. And ordinary people, middle-class people, began to think, well, maybe it's not so bad because we are not being affected. Our lives are doing better. And course, there's the famous statement by a very famous pastor, Martin Niemöller. Oh, when they came for the socialists, when they came for the communists, I didn't worry. And then they came for the Catholics. Oh, and when they came for me, there was no one left to defend me. And people got seduced.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience. And we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past.
And that reminds me of something, because I was thinking about this, and it was very good that there was this large women's march just after Trump's inauguration, but it raised something else to me in terms of the people that need to be in the streets now and doing all kinds of things now to stand up against Trump. And I thought of one thing that in particular people need to understand, because if you went around telling people, look, you're talking about fascism, you're talking about a fascist there, you're talking about somebody who, if you study what happened in Germany, you study that, you study what's happened in other places, but in particular Germany, you look at this and you can draw a lot of line between what goes on with Trump and what was going on with Hitler and the Nazis. Now, you wrote, and I wanted to give people just a sense in general about this. Like, after the Women's March, I was thinking about your book, Mothers in the Fatherland, and Women, the Family, and Nazi Politics, and it was a very heavy book. And I wanted to ask you about that. What did fascism mean for women in Germany? Because it's one thing when you hear about the men and what happened to them and how they were appealed to, and it was all the stuff that was going on specifically aimed at men, but there was a lot of stuff that was happening with women that I thought was very, very heavy and sort of, one, denied their humanity, but two, was something that a lot of people just don't know about in relation to fascism.
That's why I wrote the book, because I was in the 80s, and all my friends in Germany said, oh, yeah, my dad was bad, but my mother was really good. And so I went to the archives, and I found out that actually when you want to know how Hitler's ideology permeated at the grassroots, women are at the center of that story. They're the mothers who send their kids off to the Hitler Youth. They're the local knitting society that gets brown yarn for free. Some of them call themselves Hitler's little brown geese, can you imagine? That they were proud of being recognized as women. The head of the organization, I kid you not, the name was really Gertrude Schultz-Klink. Gertrude Schultz-Klink headed up an organization of 9 million women, all out there volunteering, collecting charity for the needy, cooking meals for the hungry, organizing charity. Everything was organized, even charity. And so women felt proud of doing their womanly activities, womanly so-called. And the fact that they were kept out of high places didn't bother them as much as we might think it would. Not that many women were in the universities to begin with.
The other place that actually had a lot to do with, like, what happened with Hitler's reputation, what happened with fascism in Germany, and how it was rolled out a carpet for them to be received on, was in the universities. And the fact that the universities actually were very open to Hitler. And that was something that really, I think, would shock a lot of people. To me, it was interesting because when I saw you really went after Heidegger, I was very happy, because you don't know how many arguments I've had with people about Heidegger.
Oh.
And, you know, people always look at him as like, oh, well, you know, we study him. So let's talk about this. What about the universities and the Nazis, the relationship there?
You would think. I work in a university, so I would think that the universities would be the first to see the danger. Not at all. First of all, actually, Jewish professors were overrepresented in the ranks of academe, and 10% of all professors were fired because they were Jewish in 1933. And in a time when there were no jobs available, that meant a lot of PhDs got jobs. So there's that absolutely material benefit. And while we're talking about Jews, also, too, middle-class professors were about as anti-Semitic as other people. But while we're talking about Jews, I'd like to ask your listeners to imagine, think of what percentage of all Germans in 1933 were Jewish. Just pause for a minute, get that percentage correct, and I bet not many of you guessed under 1%. So we're looking at a very small population, quite different from the population, the African-American population, which is around 15 to 18% in this country. And so there's a very big difference. And the amount of anti-Semitism in the universities was actually quite strong. And so that was one reason. The other thing that the Hitler administration did is to recruit followers in the universities who would serve as legal experts, who would justify racial politics. The funding dried up for what we would call liberal research, but funding was suddenly available for research in race. How race impacts literature, racial thinking impacts social work. So the racialization of the curriculum meant all kinds of new funding opportunities. And so as we're looking to what's going to happen now about funding for climate change, we can see that kind of incentive system shifting. And so suddenly the availability of jobs, funding, and prestige was irresistible. And I have to say that the historians were particularly awful. They took a lot of the history that had been written by Jews, talking about all of Jews' wonderful contributions in many, many areas, and they took all that research and they said, see, there's been a Jewish conspiracy. They just plagiarized and turned pride into insult. So the universities were not a bastion of free speech.
It's very heavy reading that in your book. In fact, as you go through it and you get all the way up to 39 and the role that the universities played, I mean, they were like steamrollers for Hitler. It was very, very heavy.
They called it the Brown steamroller.
Well, let's talk about this because I want to start getting into some of the similarities between what's happening with the Trump regime and what happened in Nazi Germany. And one of the things I can't help, and I think I wrote to you earlier about this, but you talked a lot about the professional popularizers for the Nazi regime. One put out the booklet called Der Stürmer, and the other was Das Schwarze Korps. And I read this part of the book, I kept thinking about, guess what, Breitbart. And this is kind of right there, you know?
It's right there. And of course, now we look back and the technology was primitive. But the Nazis, and one thing to remember is before 33, no politics on the radio. So radio was not an option. But the Nazis were way ahead of the curve. As soon as electric amplification of the voice became possible, they had it. They had movies. They used film strips. They had 72,000 versions of one slideshow that went out but displayed by the Hitler Youth. They were at the technological front of the media always. They had insiders, newspapers for party members, and huge mass circulation newspaper, their own national news circulation, with fake news, fake facts everywhere. And this was very, very important, that they were technologically night and day more sophisticated than any of their other political rivals.
You know, one thing that I kept thinking about as I was reading about this, now these two, particularly Der Stürmer and Das Schwarze Korps, these were two different publications, right? These were print publications, and one was from the SS and one was from the Stormtroopers, right? And one was geared towards a sort of a more brutish audience, and the other was geared towards a more intellectual audience, it seemed. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, because they understood how to segment their audience. And so that the Stürmer was filled with disgusting anti-Semitic cartoons and outrageous lies, like the National Enquirer. But the Schwarze Korps, which is for the SS, which is the elite, had scientific articles. It had pictures of important people. It looked like a professional association in the day. Had racial science there. It had geopolitics. It had interviews with government dignitaries. It appealed to the elite.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience. And we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. Let me ask you this, and this is something you also had been thinking about a lot as you wrote to me this morning, the structural similarities in situations that encourage racist populism. And you know, this is exactly what we're looking at when we're looking at the regime in power in the U.S. right now in terms of this kind of encouraging racist populism. And let's talk about that, the structural similarities in these situations.
Well, you know, I can't resist pointing out to one enormous difference, and that is, of course, the structural similarities are here. We have a group of people who feel left out, left behind, but our situation in some ways is different because, and that's why I think fascism isn't so helpful, because we have a unique situation. When you look at the white supremacy tradition in this country, we've been a country that has been for 270 years, my math is probably a little weak, we have been a country where white supremacy has been legal all years except for 77 years. Except for 77 years, we have been a white supremacist country. That didn't exist in Germany. And that makes us structurally incredibly different. And I think we always have to remember we're more like apartheid in South Africa under de Klerk than in that respect, than in Nazi Germany. So it's important when we're doing the comparisons to remember that there are some alarming differences, too, not necessarily better. But structurally, we have a developed democracy that people take for granted. We think our wonderful history is going to protect us because we tend to think of history as being upward and onward, always getting better. We don't see it as a battle. We have two traditions in this country, the tradition of the Enlightenment, the tradition of human rights, human dignity, and then we have the tradition of white supremacy, and they're both confronting one another right now. And Germany didn't have that legacy of white supremacy, and the Jewish population was minuscule. So that's one element that makes us different.
What about the similarities on the other hand?
Well, similarities, I can't resist drawing some similarities in the way in which people seem to follow an outsider leader. Now, you can look at Hitler, and of course, he's ridiculous. He's got a shock of hair. He had no political experience. He got the idea for his mustache when he saw his first Charlie Chaplin movie. He was extremely vain. He particularly liked that mop of hair that came down in front of his eyes. He had a photographer with him at all times. The photographer took pictures of his gestures, which he repeated. He could not follow a script. He had to extemporaneously speak because he had to have feedback from his audience. And in fact, in 1932, he was so vain, his photographer, personal photographer, took dozens of pictures for him in different poses so that his annual picture wouldn't look aged. He curated an image for himself, the opposite of Trump, but therefore interesting because it was extreme. He was a simple man, a bachelor, a teetotaler, a vegetarian who wore rumpled suits. He appeared kind of harmless. So that, in an odd way, won him the trust of people who were so disillusioned with the main political parties of the day. So from the opposite end of the social scale, we have this outsider capturing the disenfranchised, people who feel disenfranchised, because of an extraordinary ability to understand the media. Hitler also was a master at making headlines of the provocative statements. He would always make outrageous statements. Didn't matter if they weren't so true. He said, tell a lie, tell a big lie. It always leaves a trace.
Let's talk about this. You mentioned to me that you're very worried these days, and I want to talk about that because I think you're not alone, okay?
I'm very worried today because in some ways, Hitler was more cautious. He had to be more cautious because of the Constitution, because there was a president over him, and he never got more than a third of the vote. And there was no voter fraud in Nazi Germany, P.S. I'm very worried because what I see is a president whose ignorance is legendary. And he has a Rasputin, Steve Bannon. Hitler didn't need anybody else. Hitler read whole books, believe it or not. He only remembered what he agreed with, but still. I think I'm worried because we, like the Germans, have a political culture that depends on goodwill and shared norms, politicians who respect those norms. We take it for granted. We're looking at a regime that has a businessman's ethic, and a businessman looks for loopholes and looks at respect for your enemy, so-called, respect for your person in the other party, as being a sign of weakness or stupidity. We also have a track record in this country, a right-wing movement that's extremely well-funded. Read Dark Money. I think what frightens me most is that progressives in pre-Nazi Germany, in late Weimar Germany, progressives were blindsided by the speed and the ruthlessness with which Hitler seized power. Remember Franklin Roosevelt said in the 30s, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I think the only thing we have to fear is not being afraid enough. Even though the parallels are not perfect with Nazi Germany, what is similar is the weakness of progressives, people of goodwill, liberals, lefties, call them what you will, defenders of human rights, our weakness when confronted with overwhelming force. So that's why I'm scared.
Well, you got me too. Claudia Kunz, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
Take care now.
Bye.
And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Children